You're now listening to the Solid Monster Podcast with Jason Solomon, the best podcast in the business. I'm the Man of Steel, Mike Verna. Thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting wrestling. And keep coming down.
Oh, he's coming. He's coming. He's coming. He's coming. He's coming. He's coming. He's coming.
Did you guys just hear Nikki Cross? He's coming.
Hello, ladies.
Welcome to the 2018 Solid Monster Sounds Off Halloween Show. Now, here is your host with the most, the Solid Monster.
It's good to have you back, Zombie Solid Monster.
Rough night?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think I'll be drinking ever again.
Do you know what tomorrow night is?
I mean, Monday Night Raw?
Exactly. I give you 24 hours before you are back on the sauce.
Well, you're probably right about that. This is episode 570 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off Halloween edition. My favorite time of year. I always love doing these shows. And as you might be able to hear from the sound of my voice, it was quite the night last night at our Halloween meetup. We had a great turnout despite the nasty weather, the nasty conditions. People braved it. And they came out. I got to meet a lot of really good people. A lot of the faces I knew. Some faces I did not know. I know some people weren't able to make it out. We'll do more of these. I love hanging out with you guys. The real reason that I sound the way I sound, probably above all else, is I didn't quite realize when I decided to be the Macho Monster, because that was my costume this year. I decided, you know what? I've done Hulk Hogan before. And it's time I do the Macho Man. Because if anybody is, you think back to those old wrestlers, if anybody is probably the most, I would say, imitated pro wrestler that I typically see on Halloween, other than probably Hogan, and I saw a couple of him last night too, it would be the Macho Man. Because the guy looks like a walking cartoon character. And, you know, you just, wherever you go, you stand out. I guess unless you're doing NWO Savage, and if you're all black, people probably don't really notice. But I guess someone said you look like WCW Randy Savage, and that I had my Slim Jim colored costume on, and made sure I went out and bought a whole bunch of Slim Jims and gave them out selectively to people. I went all out, everything except the wig and the beard. That I couldn't tolerate that, but the robe with the tassels and the sleeveless shirt and the boots and the hat, and it was quite the getup. But what I didn't realize is that when you do the Macho Man impression, you've got to do the Macho Man voice. Ooh, yeah. When you do that all night long, your throat feels like it's on fire, and your throat probably bleeds. And, because, you know, Savage sounded like he was gargling concrete all the time, so... Yeah, when you do that impression all night, you don't realize until the next morning, as I'm realizing now, how much of a bad idea that probably was. So just bear with me here. But again, it was good seeing everybody last night. And also thank you specifically to Sam and to Julian for their help in setting the event up. I am very lucky to have two listeners like them, so thank you for that. Audible... Got to shout them out. Their offer for listeners of this podcast is still ongoing. If you want to get yourself a free book, all you got to do is punch in audibletrial.com/Solomonster. And you got The Hardcore Truth by Bob Holly. You've got Best Seat in the House by Justin Roberts. Two of the wrestling books that I would recommend. But you can pick anything you want to. And if you cancel your trial in those 30 days, you still get to keep your book. So audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Let's try to end October on a strong note. I've got a new sponsor that I am excited to tell you all about. The deal I reached is it, really for a couple of my pay-per-view review videos, and then I guess from there we'll see where it goes. But I wanted to share it here too. It's this thing called The Ridge. And what it is a slim wallet that comes in aluminum, titanium, or carbon fiber. I can't even really call it a men's wallet because this thing is great no matter who you are. It's good for men. It's good for women. It comes at your choice of either a money clip on the back or a cash strap. And they are all RFID blocking, which helps protect all of your credit card information from theft. People these days can steal your info just by walking, you know, close enough to you on the street without you even knowing about it. So I had the company send me one first because if I'm going to promote it, I wanted to be able to try it and, you know, make sure that it was worth promoting. So I've been using it as my main wallet now for about 2 weeks, and I love it. And that is not, you know, ad speak either. I really do like this wallet. Some of you probably saw me with it. I took it out last night out of my, since my macho costume, my macho monster costume had no pockets, I had to go out and buy myself a fanny pack, like any true pro wrestler, old school style. I had to go buy a red fanny pack to match my costume. I had all my gimmicks inside. But I took the wallet out. I was showing it off to a few people. And by the way, why do they make those costumes without pockets? Can somebody explain this? Would it be that difficult to sew a freaking pocket into the side of the damn pant leg? Anyway, these wallets are thin. They look freaking cool. You can get 10% off your first purchase right now. If you buy one, just go to ridgewallet.com/Solomonster. Then use the code Solomonster at checkout if you don't already see it listed in the promo code field. You got to put that in there. You're paying for a quality product. Just, you know, be aware of that. This is not some cheap $20 wallet. But if you want 10% off right now, just go to ridgewallet.com/Solomonster and then use the code. I have the aluminum one in navy with the cash strap. And like I said, I like it a lot. Thank you to all the people who donated. We had a lot of donations that came in overnight. That was one of the few nice things to wake up to other than the way I feel right now. So thank you. If you want to make a donation, you guys know the drill. You can always go to thesolomonster.com and you'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more, you can get a nickname and a shout-out. Chuck Lunatic Lentz. What's up, Chuck? Deadpool James Herrera. John Loose Cannon Lopez, Out of Control Cody Thomas. Today is actually Cody's birthday, so happy birthday to him. The Florida Freebird, Bryant Becerra, the Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Sean Nasty Boy Nilsson, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, Stephen Handyman Halistic, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, the Show Off, Corey Van Dam, Max the Axe Velado, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, Jared the Trump Card Justice. Thank you, brother. The Malaysian Mastermind, Samuel T. The Warlock, Sean Rue. Short Fuse, Sean Simpson. Rochester Ruff, Victor De Leon. The Portland Popstar, Paul Hamilton. The British Brainbuster, Andre Delabov, who was finally able to donate for the first time. So thank you, Andre. Deathblow, David Floyd, who turned 27 on the 27th. So happy birthday to him. Paul Money in the Banks, happy belated birthday. Paul just celebrated his 59th birthday on Friday. That's from myself and your son, Mike. So you can thank him for that as well. And Sarah from Illinois, if you're listening, thank you very much, not only for the donation, but for the birthday card. I only got it in the mail this week. I don't know why it took so long, not your fault, but that was very thoughtful of you to mail that out to me, so thank you. And I would say, how does Sweet Sapphire sound? Since I'm in a macho mood after last night. I know it's not the most original nickname, but we can call you Sweet Sapphire as your wrestling nickname. Just if you ever email me, just make sure you mention that in the email. Logan David, Orhan from Montreal, Patrick from Winston-Salem, Vicious Vince Cooper. Thank you guys so much for the kind words in iTunes. I think we've gotten through everything here. So we had a lot of business to get to here at the beginning of the show, but let's get into the real meat of it now. I have a lot to say yet about the Roman Reigns news from this week. And I did a whole video on it I didn't want to wait a full week to give my initial thoughts on the Roman Reigns news. So if you missed it, there is a video up about 20 minutes long on the YouTube channel just talking about that and a little bit about what happened at the end of Raw with Dean Ambrose. I'm not going to replay the exact audio that I did. I'm going to have all new thoughts here to talk about here when it comes to Roman Reigns, so we'll get into that. But there is a pay-per-view tonight. So let's do predictions for this supposed historic, first ever, all-women's WWE Evolution pay-per-view. So historic that I heard from multiple people who thought Crown Jewel was this weekend and not Evolution. But that's the way the ball rolled with this show. All their promotional muscle went behind the show that they're getting paid a crap ton of money for, and this one's been sort of an afterthought. So what I want to do right now, I want to splice in my predictions for Evolution. This did also go up on the YouTube channel about a day or two ago, because I did not want to wait until the very last minute to do that. So if you've already heard the Evolution predictions, you guys can skip ahead by 40 minutes. There's plenty more show to come. But if not, we've got about 40 minutes here talking nothing but Evolution, my predictions, Nikki Bella's comments where she kind of sort of trashed Triple H, but not really. I'll get into that. And then on the flip side of this, we'll talk about Crown Jewel, Roman Reigns, and a whole lot more. Emanating from the Nassau Coliseum on Long Island, right next door to my alma mater, WWE is also streaming the first half hour live and free on Twitter for the first time. I think they've ever done that for a show. So that'll be the first 30 minutes of Evolution. They had tickets for this show, probably still do, on StubHub, on SeatGeek, websites of that nature. For as little as $7, you can get into the Evolution show. And I still had no interest in going. This show, when you look at how they have promoted this show, and again, they've been talking about it as though it is historic. It is such a big deal. And you would think they would want to go out of their way to make it feel really special. And I'm floored by how poor of a job that WWE has done getting people excited for this show. I don't doubt that there are some people listening to this who might be sitting there saying, well, I'm excited for the show. I truly think those people are in the minority. Because I feel the way a lot of you people feel, which is that the build to this show has been completely underwhelming for what is supposed to be a historic show. The only thing historic here is the historically poor way that they have promoted this show. Such an important show this is, neither Raw nor SmackDown this week ended with the women, which is a staple of WWE programming. Typically, right? You've got big pay-per-view coming up this weekend, 5 days away, 6 days away, and you end your show with some sort of tease or cliffhanger or pull-apart brawl or contract signing or something to that effect. That builds to your main event, that builds to a big match on the pay-per-view that Sunday. They had two shows this week, neither one ended with the women. Could not even headline Raw or SmackDown this week. There are, I would say, two or three matches that I personally am genuinely looking forward to on this show. Two of which are not even matches with main roster talent. You know, the Mae Young Classic wrapped up this week. I mean, the finals are going to be this Sunday, but the show itself on the WWE Network had its finale on Wednesday. And the finals with Toni Storm and Io Shirai take place at Evolution. But I'm going to miss the Mae Young Classic so much because it very quickly became, probably from week one, became my favorite WWE program to watch each week. Not taking anything away from NXT. NXT is really good, especially lately. NXT has been pretty damn good. But I became a huge fan of the Mae Young Classic. And it wasn't as though we were getting, you know, blowaway matches. It's not just about blowaway matches. It was the presentation of it. It was the talent that was involved. It was just the way that it was presented. And then on top of that, you did get some pretty good matches. I like the whole package. I thought they did a tremendous job with it. I thought they did last year, too. WWE does a pretty damn good job when it comes to these tournaments and these specials that we've seen on the network. They did it with the UK guys. The Cruiserweight Classic was, I thought, tremendous. And this was no different. I wish I could be as excited for this pay-per-view as I was watching that tournament. And who knows, you know, maybe... And I'm not trying to prejudge the show. I'm not going to say the show's going to suck or anything like that. The show can end up being one of the sleeper shows of the year. You know, we've had situations like this before where WWE puts a card together and either the card doesn't look overly exciting or they did a complete crap job of promoting the show and it just feels like an afterthought. Hey, let's just get it out of the way. You know, that sort of thing. That's how this show feels. But who knows? Maybe in the end, they fire on all cylinders and it turns out to be one of the better shows of the year. I hope so. Maybe when it's over, we'll look back on it that way. But going in, I think they did a huge disservice to all of the women on this show. There will be a kickoff show starting at 6 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Eastern start time for the actual pay-per-view. It's listed as ending at 10:30, followed by the Hardy's Halloween special. I'm looking more forward to that than I am this pay-per-view. Michael Cole leads the announce team with Beth Phoenix and Renee Young. I thought they did a good job together on the Mae Young Classic, so I think that's a good combination. Lillian Garcia is going to be back to ring announce. She'll be joining JoJo. And I'm sure we'll have a few female referees out there. So they're, you know, they're making sure that they're well represented. And I don't know if they'll have maybe they'll bring back Mike McGurk as a timekeeper. Hey, why not bring back Mike McGurk as a special guest ring announcer for one match? Maybe for the Battle Royal or something. In the press release that WWE initially put out in July, when they initially announced this show, they advertised that there would be an NXT UK Women's Championship title defense. And there has been no mention of that at all whatsoever of late, so I assume that idea is out the window. I won't say who the champion is right now because I have no idea if that's airing on the NXT UK television show. That's now on the network, when that might be airing. If it does, it may not be for a few more months. You know what? I don't even know anymore what's a spoiler and what's not. People are just, they're so damn sensitive about these things, but I know it hasn't aired yet, so I won't say. Point is, as I am recording this, there is no NXT UK women's title match being promoted. So if it does get added to the show, it'll be an unannounced thing. And I guess it'll be them spoiling who the champion is. And my guess is they probably just didn't expect it to take this long to find a home for the show. I know they were shopping it around to different TV networks over in the UK. They had some interest from one or two. It didn't work out. And so they had no choice. Kind of like with Legends House. They were shopping Legends House around the reality show many years ago. They wanted, I think they were talking to like if it was Bravo or A&E and USA and channels like that. And there was just no interest in carrying it. So they ended up putting it on the network. So my guess is it delayed their plans. It just took longer than they had hoped to find a home for the show, and they probably won't be airing that not title change, but I guess the new champion, the match to decide a new champion if it airs, probably won't be for a couple more months. So here's the card as of right now. I'll run through these real quick and just give my predictions. The match that I am looking forward to the most is the finals of the Mae Young Classic. I have been following this tournament week after week. It is built to what I think could be a tremendous final. Io Shirai, who some people call the best wrestler, female wrestler in the entire world, she takes on Toni Storm in the finals. And I'm going to go with Toni Storm here. I think Toni Storm wins. We had Kairi Sane, who is Io's best friend. She won the tournament last year. And there's been a huge Japanese influence even this year on the tournament. You've had probably four different Japanese stars in this tournament. You had, I think, Chinese-American. I mean, people from different backgrounds and nationalities. But there has been a noticeable Japanese influence on the tournament this year as well. I just don't know that they want to take another Japanese star and you know, put her over, I don't know, back-to-back years. That's part of my reasoning, but I also just think that they see, you know, star potential in Toni Storm. I think everybody can see star potential. I mean, Toni Storm's only 22 years old, which is kind of shocking in a way when you think about it. And I just think, I don't know, I think this year she fell short last year. She made it to the semifinals and was eliminated. I think this year she takes it. And so I'm going with Toni Storm. Also, the other thing to remember is last year, I don't believe Toni Storm was signed to any kind of deal. I think she was already signed with Stardom for a year, and she couldn't, you know, sign anything full-time with WWE. Now she is under contract. She's going to be part of the NXT UK Women's Division. So they have her, I think, pretty much locked up, and that's also part of the reason why I think they might be more open to having her win the whole thing this year. We have a Battle Royal for a future championship match. This is the obligatory, we don't have anything for you to do, and so we'll just dump you in a gigantic battle royal, because we're lazy. The roster as of right now includes Asuka, and Asuka won this year's Royal Rumble match back in January, first ever Women's Royal Rumble, and I don't see her winning this also. The same year that she won the Royal Rumble, they're going to put her over in a battle royal. I don't see it, so I don't think Asuka's taking this. We also have Naomi, Carmella, Nia Jax, Ember Moon, Alicia Fox. Actually, Alicia Fox, I don't know if Alicia Fox is in this Battle Royal anymore because she's been moved into another match, which we'll get to in a second. Dana Brooke, Lana, Zelina Vega, Billie Kay, Peyton Royce, Mandy Rose, Sonya Deville, Tamina, Tori Wilson, Michelle McCool, Alundra Blaze, the former Medusa, has been added to this match. Her first match since 2000 in WCW, that's 18 years ago. I think she's got to be in her mid to late 50s now. Although she still looks pretty damn good. So she'll be in there. Ivory, Molly Holly, Kelly Kelly, and Maria Kanellis. So I didn't add up all the names. I think it comes out, and maybe I'm missing a couple of names, but I believe the count was at 21. And so if they have to bounce Alicia Fox out, then they'll be at an even 20, so that's fine. As far as who wins, you know, I looked over this roster here. It's, I mean, it's impossible to say. I mean, they could want to put a legend over. They might want to shock you and go for somebody you're not expecting. I don't think it's going to be Asuka. I don't think it has to be Asuka. I'm going to pick Ember Moon. I think Ember Moon is going to win the Battle Royal. I would actually have it come down to Asuka and Ember. Have them go at it for a little while, and then have Ember win. Asuka doesn't have to win this. She just needs a strong showing. And the SmackDown team, the SmackDown writing team over there, needs to get their act together after Evolution is all said and done, and get her back into the mix. Move beyond Charlotte and Becky after this show. Let Becky and Asuka go at it for a bit. Let them have a couple of matches together. Frankly, they have so many women down in NXT and at the Performance Center, especially after this Mae Young Classic, they signed a whole bunch of people. I'd like to see some new faces moved up to the SmackDown women's roster because they could really use some new blood in that division. I have a little less faith if they move them to Monday Night Raw. I have marginally more faith if they move them up to SmackDown, but not that much more. But they need some new blood. They need some new faces on that show. Maybe Asuka could even, you know, if not with Ember... Maybe, and I guess she wouldn't work a program with Ember because they're on separate shows. But, I mean, even if she's not in the title mix right away, you know, Asuka could work a program with a new face that they promote from, you know, down at the Performance Center up to the main roster. Whoever that may be. I don't know if it would be somebody who's TV ready like, you know, a Candice LeRae or, I mean, Bianca Belair, it's too early. But just get her back into the mix. Get her working with people that she can work with and... I just don't want to see her sitting on the sidelines. I don't want to see her feeling the glow with Naomi. They should be doing more with this woman. She won your Royal Rumble, for crying out loud. We have Sasha Banks. Oh, speaking of women they could be doing more with. Sasha Banks, Bayley, and Natalya against the Riot Squad in a six-woman tag team match. The match is a Monday Night Raw special. This is a Monday Night Raw delight. Or fright, depending on how you look at it. And I like Ruby, and obviously I'm a Sasha Banks fan. You know, probably less so the other people in this match, but it's just one of those things. And I understand them wanting to get every. It's like their WrestleMania, right? They want to look at what they're doing here. The Battle Royal. They are doing what they do at WrestleMania every year, which is we have to try to get everybody on the show. We don't want anybody to feel as though they're left out of this. Even though I bet a bunch of women who were shoved into that Battle Royal feel exactly like they've been sort of left out of things and forgotten about. But it's one of those things where you hear about this match, and it just feels like something you've seen every single week on Monday Night Raw, or some combination every single week. Now, Sasha told Maria Menounos, they were on a podcast, I guess, together. She told Maria Menounos that she was sidelined for the last month or so with post-concussion symptoms. That's why she was off television. There was some sort of undisclosed injury. WWE was very vague about it. I don't know why they're vague about things like that. It's not like she was suffering from some friggin' STD or something. But anyway, they're very secretive about this stuff. And in the end, Sasha came out and she revealed that this is what she was suffering from. And maybe Sasha didn't want them to. If Sasha did not want them to reveal that information, then that's understandable. But it didn't seem like anything that was overly, that big of a deal. So I don't really see what the problem there would have been. So WWE's hands were tied in that respect. She was hurt. And if you know that somebody is hurt, if there's a question that they may or may not be on the pay-per-view, at that point, yes, it would be hard to slot them into a bigger match on the show if you don't know if they're going to be ready or not. Look at Alexa Bliss. Alexa Bliss, we just found out, is not going to be cleared. She's not going to be ready for the pay-per-view this weekend. So I get that. In a way, WWE's hands were tied, right? But the thing of it is, had she not been hurt, I am not convinced at all that WWE would have come up with something much better for her than what she's doing here. Just judging by what they've done with her all year, I say that with the utmost confidence. I give them only a little bit of latitude on this. And that's sad, is what that is. That's really sad. So as far as who wins the match, I would have to, Sasha got pinned by Ruby Riott, I think, on Raw Monday night. And I think it's about time they try to, give her or her and Bayley some momentum here. And so I'm going to go with the baby faces to win here in this match. That brings us to Lita and Trish Stratus. They were to have faced the team of Mickey James and Alexa Bliss. However, Alexa suffered either a concussion or a broken nose, depending on who you believe. I believe it's a concussion. At a live event in Hartford last weekend, and she will not be cleared in time to compete at the pay-per-view, although she will be there. She will be at ringside. Instead, though, she will be cornering the team of Mickey James and Alicia Fox. And Alicia Fox and Mickey James beat up on Lita and Trish on Monday night. It kind of felt at that point, because Alexa was nowhere to be found, there's Alicia. And so it looked like she was sort of the standby, she was the alternate. And now, all of a sudden, Alicia Fox, of all people, has, I guess, one of the bigger matches, one of the bigger attractions on this pay-per-view. And here again, I get that injuries happen. This was out of their control. But why could they not have done Trish Stratus and Lita against Sasha Banks and Bayley? I mean, would that not have been the obvious match going into this show? Again, I know Sasha's been out hurt for a few weeks, but think back to how early they announced the Trish Stratus-Alexa Bliss match. They announced that match, I want to say months ago. Many, many, many weeks ago. Longer than Sasha has been out hurt. Almost immediately, they announced that match. Do you not think that that would be a better attraction than this? Even if Alexa was in this match. Do you not think what I just mentioned would not be a bigger attraction than the match that we are getting here? Even Trish one-on-one with Sasha Banks to play off their little interaction that they had together in the Women's Royal Rumble match, which some people may not remember, but they did. They went at it a little bit in that match, and people seemed to eat it up. I think that could be a big match. Maybe they're going to save it for WrestleMania. Maybe I'm being naive again and giving them the benefit of the doubt on that. I say that now. Watch, come April, Sasha will be relegated to the Battle Royal again on the show. So yeah, maybe they're saving it for another pay-per-view. But I look at this. First ever women's pay-per-view. You want to really promote it. You want to sell tickets. You want to make it out to feel like a big deal. You're going to get some big-time matches on the show as far as, the names in the women's division are concerned. I don't know. Trish and Sasha. Sounds like a big match to me. Even Trish and Lita against Sasha and Bayley. despite all the crap that we've seen them do with Sasha and Bayley over the last 6 months. To me, that would have been a far bigger match. And they chose not to do that. Instead, we're left with this. And I'm going to go... I mean, Lita and Trish Stratus, to me, I mean, it's just an obvious thing. I don't really see how they can lose this match, especially now. Now, it's Alicia Fox and Mickie James, for crying out loud. I would have to assume that Alicia now is going to be the one in there to take the fall. I just hope Lita doesn't kill herself when she goes to do that moonsault. But I'm picking Trish and Lita. We have the NXT Women's Championship on the line. This is the other match I'm looking forward to. I had mentioned there being three matches on the show that I was looking forward to. One of which being the Mae Young Classic Finals. And the other being this one. And then also the Becky Lynch match. But it's going to be Kairi Sane defending against Shayna Baszler. Shayna Baszler lost her championship to Kairi. This is the rematch. And, you know, I've gone back and forth on this here. And as far as, you know, who goes over and what they could do. And I'm picking Shayna Baszler. I am picking Shayna Baszler. I do think she's going to win the championship back. It may end up being the lone title change on this show. But I think she wins. And, you know, as far as who she then goes and defends it. Now, I was thinking... The other two horsewomen who are in training who haven't made their debut yet, Jessamyn Duke and Marina Shafir, I would assume they're going to be at the show. They may well be ringside for Shayna's match and or Ronda's match, as they have been before. And it would not surprise me at all to see them get involved in this match in some way. And maybe give Shayna, if she needs it, against Kairi, some sort of assist or distraction or something, and maybe help her win the championship, and this is what establishes them now. This is their debut, and this is what establishes them on television, and maybe they can actually be with Shayna. It could almost be like her entourage going forward. So that's one way I could see this going down. I was also thinking, well, maybe Kairi retains. We've seen Bianca Belair on NXT television, especially just this week, yelling at William Regal, I'm undefeated, I'm undefeated, I want a championship match, I'm undefeated. And it's much more believable for me to think that it would be Belair against Kairi Sane, and not Belair as a heel against another heel in Shayna Baszler. Or we could end up with some kind of a triple threat at the next TakeOver show, where Kairi gets her rematch and they also stick Bianca in there. That's also very possible. But I think Bianca Belair is going to be in the mix very soon. In fact, if it were me, I wouldn't wait much longer to put that championship on her. Keep her down there. I don't want to see her yet on the main roster. God, it's sad. It's sick. It's almost sickening that I have to be worried about that. But they have something special in her. I don't want to see that ruined in any way. I'd like to see her establish as a dominant champion in NXT and get some time down there before being promoted. So I'm picking Shayna Baszler to regain the championship. And we have the SmackDown Women's Championship on the line. Not the main event, apparently, but it will be Charlotte challenging Becky Lynch in a last woman standing match. The lone SmackDown match on this entire show, unless you count the Battle Royal, which has a few SmackDown names in it. This is only the second last woman standing match in company history, the first one being just last year in NXT between Asuka and Nikki Cross. Becky Lynch should absolutely not lose that championship here in this match. She should win. I think she will win. I'm picking her. Bully Ray, on his Busted Open radio show that he now co-hosts, he pitched an idea. To try to get Becky cheered like a... Or not cheered like a heel, but booed like a heel. Like a real heel. Which, you know, I still think is ridiculous. People's love for this woman has not really waned. Hardly at all. She'll get scattered boos, but by and large, people still love her. They still cheer for her. You know, it's like... I think about what happens when she beats Charlotte. And she moves on to another babyface, like Asuka, just using her as an example. She moves on, let's say, next to Asuka. Or she moves on to... I can't even name another top babyface female on this show. She already worked with Carmella. Naomi? I guess. This is why they need some new women on this show. But, you know, like, they seem so desperate to turn Becky heel. But they have no baby faces to challenge her for the championship once they get beyond Charlotte. And I even struggle to call her a baby face because she doesn't exactly get cheered like one when she comes out on most weeks. Not at the level I'm sure they're hoping for. But my point is, let's say she moves on to Asuka. Okay, just using her as an example. Asuka may be a strong enough fan favorite to get people to cheer for her over Becky. Maybe. But it's equally possible, if not more likely, that the fans just keep cheering for Becky. And they end up doing so at the expense of whoever they put in that spot. It could be Asuka, it could be Naomi, it could be Lana, God forbid, it could be any number of people. And they end up getting hurt by it. Because the people don't want to boo Becky. So they'll just boo the other person. And it ends up getting them booed. And so I worry a little bit about that. But anyway, his idea to get her booed would be to have Charlotte bleed during the match, which he acknowledges is not going to happen. But to get her to bleed and have Ric Flair come out, or he may already be out at ringside, because Ric Flair is going to be at Evolution. He's already been announced. He will be there. I don't know if he'll just come out with his daughter and wave and go to the back. I don't know if he'll be at ringside. I have no idea. But he'll be there, and so you have Ric Flair come out in an act of concern for his daughter. Ric Flair was a literal member of Evolution. So, of course, he'll be on this show. But anyway, Bully says, have him not get, like, punched in the face or shoved down, but have him, like, trip and fall. This was his idea. Trip and fall, and or take a bump of some kind, and then have Becky grab a chair and threaten to pummel him with it unless Charlotte stays down for the 10 count. You'd probably, honestly, in that case, you would just have people in the crowd cheering her on to do it. It's like when a heel, you know, beats down a bit, like hits their finish on a babyface and they go to leave and everyone chants one more time because they're so sympathetic to these babyfaces. That's probably what they would do here. But I do agree if you want to try to get the people to hate on this woman, that would be one way to do it because Ric Flair is beloved. Ric Flair is, you know, to a lot of people, he's Teflon Rick, and no matter what his flaws may be, they love him to death. He's the greatest of all time. So yes, that might work. I don't really care how they do it, personally. I don't care at this point. As long as she keeps the title, it would be a big mistake to take that championship off of her right now. I know there were stories of her being injured a couple of weeks ago that she may have suffered a cracked jaw in her Super Showdown match with Charlotte. The only way I would see her losing here, and I would hope that this would be the only way, is if she's hurt, and I hope she's not. But if she is hurt and she needs time off to heal up her jaw, if her jaw is still an issue, then they may very well take the championship off of her. But I've not heard anything new about her. And look, if she had a severe enough injury, they wouldn't clear her to perform. So I assume she's fine. She needs to win this match. And she needs to move on to someone else. Now that leads us to what they are billing as the main event. Raw Women's Champion Ronda Rousey, her first pay-per-view main event, taking on Nikki Bella. And I saw the same reports that many of you did, I'm sure, that as soon as they announced this match, there was a spike. There was a spike in ticket sales. Didn't sell the show out, but people seem to have an interest in this match. And it's not hard to see why. They've taken the road of promoting it, you know, as almost like in a work shoot kind of way. Ronda was going after Nikki for sleeping with John Cena, and then Nikki kind of went in on Ronda Monday night during the contract signing segment. They made it personal, and so all the people sort of lap it up and they love it. And look, it probably was the best way to go about promoting this match. Probably. To bring up some of that stuff, and you know, you were a diva, diva's like a four, and I'm going to talk about this diva stuff here in a second. But anyway, the match is what it would not have been my main event, but I guess it's a match that some people want to see. And they've been practicing and rehearsing the match all week long to make sure they get it down just the right way. It's like a Savage Steamboat here. So we'll see what kind of match they have. Nikki Bella was always, I think, the better in-ring of the two Bellas. And so she's not a bad wrestler. You know, Ronda's still new to all this. She hasn't even been doing this a full year yet. I've been impressed by her, but it's a crapshoot. You don't know what you're going to get here. We haven't seen Nikki Bella in a big singles match in a very long time. She was away for a while. This is new. Like I said, this is new territory for Ronda. They've not worked together before. So I am morbidly curious how this match is going to turn out. I hope they have a barn burner. What else can I say? I hope they go out there and they tear it up. I have my doubts, but we'll see. We'll see if they impress me. Ronda Rousey, I don't think should be losing her championship. Would it be mega heat if Nikki Bella somehow cheated, if Brie got involved and they stole the championship from Ronda? Would people boo and be pissed off? Yes, they would be. I still think it would be a mistake to have Ronda Rousey lose to Nikki Bella. So hopefully that does not happen. And maybe there's some sort of a non-finish because they want to come back and do this match again. I wouldn't do that in your main event. I would have more of a decisive finish, whatever that may be. I think Ronda should keep her title. Now, I did want to talk about Nikki Bella made some comments this week. I would call them, just reading how they came off to me, I would say worked shoot comments on the CBS Sports In This Corner podcast, where she defends the use of the word diva. And she basically said that she is personally offended when people thumb their nose at the women who wrestled in the Divas era. Now, she correctly pointed out in this interview that Beth Phoenix and Melina and AJ Lee and Paige are all former Divas champions. Which is true. She said that it is hypocritical for fans to praise the Attitude Era and bra and panties matches. And by the way, when people praise the Attitude Era, I don't think they're specifically praising the bra and panties. I mean, look, you know, teenage me and teenage a lot of people probably didn't mind it so much, okay? But when I think back to the Attitude Era and how fun it was, the first thing that comes into my mind is not bra and panties matches. When I talk about there being certain elements of that era that they can incorporate into the product now while keeping it PG, I'm not saying it has to go, you know, TV-14. I'm not thinking, hey, they ought to bring back bra and panties matches. So that to me is a bullshit point. When people romanticize about that era, I don't believe that most people are thinking about that. They're thinking about having actual stars back then. People not being handcuffed creatively. People not having every word scripted out for them. Having an atmosphere where it felt like truly anything can happen each and every single week. Has nothing to do with the women. So I think that's a bullshit point. But she thinks it's hypocritical. Praise the Attitude Era, but yet you discredit the women who worked hard because there's a butterfly on the belt that they didn't design. She says, that is not empowering. You see, you people are not empowering Nikki Bella when you make these horrible comments. Now, again, I say work shoot because in the very same interview, she actually takes a couple of shots at Triple H by saying that they were only following the orders of WWE Creative by trying to make the term diva mean strong and powerful. And then Triple H and others went and turned it into a negative term. There is no way that Nikki Bella is saying that on her own. AJ Lee spoke out against Stephanie McMahon very publicly on social media, and she knew she had one foot out the door, so she didn't have anything to lose. She legitimately went after Stephanie McMahon on Twitter for comments that she made. And people lauded her for it. So, let's have Nikki Bella sling some mud at Stephanie's husband. And maybe the people will get behind her too. Yeah, nice try. Ain't gonna work on me. But look, this is not complicated. The fans got tired of 30-second Divas matches on TV that serve no purpose. They got tired of seeing women who, in a lot of cases, quite frankly, just were not very good compared to some of the newer faces that people started to see coming up from NXT. So they rebelled. And eventually, the company reversed course. It took them a long time, but they finally came around and they finally reversed course. And that's where this whole women's movement began to bubble up in the company. The company doomed those ladies for all the crap that people would talk about the divas period in the company and all that. Okay, the company doomed each and every one of those women from day one just by calling them divas. On that, Nikki Bella is correct. But Nikki Bella needs to realize that no matter how many years WWE tried to condition the fans to think about divas as strong and powerful, diva is not used as a term of endearment. Unless you are a pop star. And even then, a lot of times, it is not exactly used as an endearing term. It'd be like having an entire division of men on the roster and calling them shitheads. The shitheads are strong, powerful, manly men. Yes, but they're still shitheads. If you are, like I said, if you're a female singer, they call you a diva. Right? These women are not singers. Diva is defined as a self-important person who is temperamental and difficult to please. Or as the Urban Dictionary so eloquently puts it, diva is a polite way of calling a self-absorbed narcissistic woman a bitch. That is how WWE referred to its female talent roster for years. And by the way, the word diva applies to men too. It's not just used for women, it's non-gender specific. Plenty of men can be divas. Case in point, Kanye West. I mean, who runs up on stage and interrupts somebody else's acceptance speech at an award show? A diva, that's who. So that's my whole spiel on the whole diva thing. Nikki Bella can talk about how it upsets her and everything, and she's got a point in that the company is as much to blame for that as anything. And I do think a lot of those women get unfairly knocked. Although, again, there were plenty of them who just, you know, they worked hard, but the talent level just wasn't there. You know, but I do think, I do think back to people who were not good at all at first because they probably got plucked out of some kind of modeling catalog. I look at somebody like a Candice Michelle who came out of the Diva Search. I mean, a few people came out of the Diva Search. Maria came out of the Diva Search. But over time, Candice in particular, and I'm kind of surprised she's not part of this show in any way, or Melina, although I guess there's some kind of issue going on there. Victoria, yeah, come to think of it, there's a lot of women. AJ Lee. There's a lot of women who should be represented in some way on this show. Maybe they'll include them in some kind of video package. I still have no clue what's going on as far as the whole, you know, Melina Victoria thing is concerned. I mean, I have my thoughts on the Victoria thing, but even that's not reason enough. You know, the images and the videos of her that leaked a while back, it wasn't her fault. I struggled to come up with an explanation for that, but you know, there were plenty of women who worked hard, who did improve, Candice Michelle being one of them. One idea that I think would be kind of cool, maybe they do this before the main event, before the women come out for the main event, but you have, like, maybe some sort of, you know, display on stage showing the different, you know, championship belts from over the years, and maybe holding those titles are some of the past champions. So you could even fly, you know, Wendi Richter, you know, in, and she's holding the old, you know, championship. And I know Alundra is going to be in the Battle Royal. Maybe she comes out and she's holding, you know, the title that she put in the trash on Nitro. And she's there holding that title, representing that era. And you have Trish and or Lita come back out and they're holding the women's title. Almost like a parade of champions, sort of, showing the evolution not just of the physical titles, but just the evolution of the women's division. I just thought that might be a cool little thing for them to do, you know, before the main event. I guess would be Ronda and Nikki before they come out for the final match. They have been handing out signs to the fans for a few weeks now. I'm sure you've seen them if you've watched Raw or SmackDown. Saying, "We want women's tag championships." They did it again on SmackDown Tuesday night. One of our listeners, Joe, was handed one by security at the SmackDown taping in Newark. And they've made sure to get shots of the signs on TV on both shows recently. So this is their way of being able to turn around and say, "We heard your voices," when they ultimately announce new women's tag team titles, which I expect them to do at this pay-per-view. I do believe that they'll make the announcement, probably have Stephanie, come out and make the announcement on this show. The physical belts were created months ago. This is according to Belt Fan Dan. Belt Fan Dan on Twitter has made belts for WWE in the past. He's a pretty, you know, well-known belt maker. And he said this back in July when the initial announcement for this pay-per-view was made, that the belts were done. They were already physically made. They were created. They have white straps. And obviously we've not heard anything about them since. But all of a sudden these signs have been popping up. So the tag titles have been a done deal now for months. There was never any doubt that they were going to happen. It was just a matter of when they actually make the announcement. But I love, you know, again, this notion that, hey, we've seen your signs, right? You people wanted it, and so we're going to give it to you, when in actuality, this was already a done deal probably 3 or 4 months ago. But, you know, look, in a perfect world, when Stephanie comes out to speak and take credit for the women's revolution, they would have AJ Lee's music hit as a surprise, and have her come out to cut another scathing promo, this time on Stephanie, and cut a scathing promo on her for taking credit. All the things that the internet fans love to talk about, oh, Stephanie loves to take credit for the women's revolution, this is bullshit, what about AJ, what about all these other women? It would play right into those people by having Stephanie come out and just be, you know, the heel that she loves to come out and be and take credit for everything, and then all of a sudden the music hits, people aren't expecting it, and they go crazy, and AJ comes out, you give her a live mic. I don't know, I just think, and it could be their way of her putting, you know, the heel, putting Stephanie in her place, and talking about how all of these women, you know, deserve credit for, you know, helping get this division and get this company to where it is today. I would just, that's just, again, pie in the sky. I would love to think the no AJ thing has less to do with who she's married to, and is just because they're actually saving her as a surprise. But I am not naive enough to think that there's a real chance of that happening. But I do think that would be a cool idea. So that's the card. That's the Evolution card as it stands right now. Again, overall, top to bottom, you look at the lineup, not overly inspiring. I am looking forward very much, though, to the Mae Young Classic Finals. That more than any other match on this show. And look, sometimes you go into shows with low expectations, and that honestly is the best way to go into it. There have been a lot of WWE pay-per-views in the past that have not looked that good on paper, or could have been a hell of a lot better on paper than they were going in. You set your expectations very low, you have no expectations, and then you come out of it thinking, man, that was one of the best shows all year. Maybe we'll look back and say the same thing for this Evolution show. Here is your Crown Jewel update for this week. The latest on the murder journalist, the one who the Saudi Crown Prince said that he and his government had nothing to do with. Nothing at all. He just walked out of the consulate that day that he went missing. Right? That's what they originally said. Oh, he left that day. He walked out of the consulate. Then their story changed. Then their story changed to, well, it was a team of 15 men who flew to Turkey to confront the guy inside the consulate, which led to a fist fight. And when he screamed, one of the men put him in a chokehold and killed him accidentally. This was not a premeditated attack. This was an accident. That was their next story. Well, now their story changed yet again. This is the gang that can't shoot straight here. And now they admit, yeah, it was premeditated after all. On their own state-run news media, the Saudi prosecutor admitted that the murder was premeditated. Based on new information, they claim that they received from a joint investigation conducted in Turkey. But it matters not, though, to WWE. Sweet Saudi Money 2, Electric Boogaloo, will take place as planned in Riyadh this Friday. They included this statement in their third quarter financial results this week. They said WWE has operated in the Middle East for nearly 20 years and has developed a sizable and dedicated fan base. Considering the heinous crime committed at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, the company faced a very difficult decision as it relates to its event scheduled for November 2nd. Similar to other U.S.-based companies who plan to continue operations in Saudi Arabia, the company has decided to uphold its contractual obligations to the General Sports Authority and stage the event. Full year 2018 guidance is predicated on the staging of the Riyadh event as scheduled. For all of us layman folks, allow me to translate that. In fact, tickets finally went on sale for the event. About time, I guess, right? You're having an event in a week. Probably should put tickets on sale. They put tickets on sale for the event. Crown Jewel is now, according to the Saudi Minister of Sports, sold out. Now, I got a message from a listener who lives in Saudi Arabia. I heard from him many months ago, in fact, before the Greatest Royal Rumble. He emailed me again. He requested I not mention his name. But he showed me a graphic. You know that graphic you would see on, like, Ticketmaster where it shows you the seating chart? He sent me a seating chart for this event. And he said that once tickets went on sale, it was very frustrating, as it was for the Greatest Royal Rumble. And the reason is, up close to the ring, in the sections most close to where the ring is, you have this purple section, which is reserved for what he says are rich people who don't even really watch wrestling at all. And then you have the red section in front of the camera, the hard camera, that is reserved for couples only. So you must bring your wife or your girlfriend, your daughter, female companion of some kind, even if they don't watch wrestling. In many cases, they probably don't watch wrestling. Then he showed me the blue sections, which I guess is for just everybody else, all the single folks, and they're all the way in the back, or all the way up top. And so he said, even at the Greatest Royal Rumble, people were loud, but they were very far away from the ring, so it didn't really translate. Now, this is going to be a smaller venue, so, you know, in a bigger stadium, an outdoor stadium, sound travels up. That may have had something to do with it as well, so it might be louder this time, but I thought it would be interesting just to mention that, because that's coming from somebody who lives in Saudi Arabia, who is very frustrated with how the whole ticketing process went down. Two big names who seem to agree with all of this hate for Crown Jewel, and you hear people saying, I can't believe they're going over there. How do the wrestlers feel? And you hear stories about wrestlers who don't want to go. Well, two people who apparently agree with that sentiment or echo that sentiment and who may not be going to Saudi Arabia for the show are John Cena and Daniel Bryan. Cena is scheduled to be part of the U.S. Open. Because it's not really a World Cup. And Bryan is scheduled to challenge AJ Styles for the WWE Championship, which is one of the feature matches on the card. Now, Barstool Sports was first to break the news that both guys had communicated to WWE that they had no interest in partaking in the show, given the whole situation that's been going on. Pro Wrestling Sheet has since confirmed that Daniel Bryan is refusing to go. They have not been able to confirm the same for John Cena, although Barstool said pretty declaratively, as of a few days ago, on their Twitter, that Cena is still 100% off the show. And that was as of 2 days ago that they reported that. Now, John Pollock reported that WWE was hopeful they could convince Cena to do the show and come to terms, but there's been no movement on Cena's part so far. Excuse me. So that's three. Oh boy. Oh man. I'm dying over here. Oh my God. Oh, I'm dying over here. My voice is going. I thought I was going to be able to get through the show, but it's not sounding too good right now. Oh, just give me a second here. I'm getting through this show. I don't care if it takes me all day. I'm getting through the show. So that is three different people. That's three different people confirming with their own sources that there is something going on here. So this is not just some bullshit story. And yeah, just because Cena may end up showing up doesn't mean this is not a legitimate story. It's an ongoing thing. And again, when you have three or four different, you know, news sites and people talking about this, then you know that there's smoke to that fire. So that's what's going on there. Now, WWE has not denied any of this. They issued a very vague statement to the news that Cena and Bryan were not going to be going, saying only, as always, we maintain an open line of communication with our performers and will address each situation accordingly. So as a PR person, I read that and I say, well, they just confirmed it. They're not going to come right out and say it. But if these stories were bullshit, they would come out and they would say there's no truth to them whatsoever. They would have John Cena and or Daniel Bryan come out with their own statement saying that there's no truth to it. So there is something definitely going on here. Now, with Cena, there's not much they can do, right? I mean, what can they really do to him? He's a made man. He can do what he wants. Bryan, less so. He's not quite at that level, I don't think, but he doesn't strike me as being somebody who is overly bothered by the money aspect of things. So if he feels that strongly about it, then he won't be there. It's simple as that. He will not be there. And I don't know then what the backup plan would be as far as the WWE title is concerned. But this has just, it's turned into a total, complete shit show. And it's one of their own making. You know, you choose to do business with people like this, these are the headaches that you're going to run into. It ain't the first, and I guarantee you it won't be the last time either. Especially, they got a 10-year deal. Guarantee you this won't be the last time something like this happens. The one thing I sincerely hope they do not air that propaganda video like they aired in April. I cannot adequately express how slimy and awful that would be after all this, if they run the show, and they are, to run that video. And, you know, here's the thing. You have this video, right? And it's basically promoting the government and how progressive the government is. If it's in the contract, they probably will do it. But, you know, at what point do you take a stand and say, no, we're not going to do this. We'll do this, but we've got a compromise here. We're not going to do that. I guess we'll find out soon enough. We're less than a week away. For those people watching, a lot of people aren't going to watch the show. But we'll find out soon enough exactly how big their balls are, I guess. So they are all in for Crown Jewel. And yet, they pulled their talent from Megyn Kelly's show on NBC after she defended the use of blackface for Halloween costumes on her show. That apparently was a bridge too far for WWE. Now, it didn't matter in the end anyway, because Megyn Kelly got shit-canned. She's no longer even employed, I don't think, by NBC. So there is that. Speaking of racism, Hulk Hogan gave an interview to the Orlando Sentinel and said that he is looking forward to going to Saudi Arabia with WWE as well as WrestleMania. They are moving forward at a rapid pace, he said, I guess in the conversations they're having or negotiations. It is exciting to have this opportunity again after all these years where I was there and gone. Now, he never actually said that he would be at Crown Jewel. I see a lot of people, like even at the meetup last night, some people came up to me and said, what do you think about Hulk Hogan being at Crown Jewel? And I was quick to point out that there's never been, well, first of all, WWE hasn't announced it, but they may want to save it as a surprise. But even still, he never said he would be at Crown Jewel specifically. He just said he was looking forward to going to Saudi Arabia and WrestleMania, which is next year. And I'm sure there'll be another Saudi Arabia show, probably right after WrestleMania next year. He may well have been referring to that. So I didn't take this as any kind of confirmation that he'll be there on Friday. He may be, but I think people may have been reading a little, you know, too much into it. But he's been promoting this NWO reunion meet and greet Q&A event that I think it took place last night, I believe. WWE was promoting it on their own social media, even though it wasn't a WWE event. They were definitely helping him promote it. And I know there was a Reddit user this week who claimed that Kevin Nash, he was at some sort of fan convention or something, and claimed that Kevin Nash told him that the reason that that event was being done was to gauge the fan reaction to WWE possibly inducting the NWO into the Hall of Fame. Look, there may be some morsel of truth to that. Let's be honest here. They did it to make money. The number one reason why they did that was to make money. That is and always will be reason number one. That's why they did it. They're going into the Hall of Fame at some point regardless. It's just a matter of when. It's not a matter of if. You know, I mean, the thing is, they already took Hogan out once. They put him in the Hall of Fame. They took him out. I guess being banished from the website apparently constitutes one being taken out of the Hall of Fame. And so at some point, what's funny about it is they'll end up putting him in a second time once things blow over in their view. Of course, for some people, it'll never blow over, but far be it from WWE to actually give a shit about that. When they think they're in the clear, believe me, Hogan will be back on TV. He'll be going back into the Hall of Fame again. By the way, in the same interview, they asked Hogan about all the stories about him over the years, holding down younger talent while he was on top, and he admitted that, in fact, that is exactly what he did. This was his quote. He says, once I got in the spot, to keep the spot, that's where the politics came in. Everybody goes, well, Hulk Hogan was a politician. Well, thank God I was. That's why I made more money than anybody. That's why I kept the belt longer. That's why instead of a 5 or 6 or 10 year run like The Rock or Stone Cold, I had a 35-year run on top. Wow. That might be the most honest thing I've ever heard Hulk Hogan say. On Raw Monday night, Roman Reigns made his announcement that he had been diagnosed with a recurrence of leukemia, which was sort of a double news item in that not only was he diagnosed, but the fact that it was a recurrence. Not too many people knew that he had been diagnosed about 10 or 11 years earlier with the disease. I know Triple H knew, because Triple H has since talked about this and said that he knew a while back, and it was Roman's choice not to talk about it because he didn't want people thinking that things were being handed to him because he had been sick or anything like that. And he was going to decide on his own terms when he would come forward at some point later in his career with this announcement. And unfortunately, he was forced into it a lot earlier than he wanted to. But it was a very emotional speech that he gave on Monday night. When he announced this, he surrendered the Universal Championship. And as I said earlier, I did a whole 20-minute video on this that's up on the YouTube channel on Monday night right after he made this announcement. And he revealed this publicly for the very first time that, again, he has this pre-existing condition. That's really what it was. I mean, Roman has had for years this pre-existing condition that hardly anybody knew about. There had been rumors all day that day that something was going on, that he was going to come out and make some kind of announcement. He may have been injured because he had missed all of the weekend live events. Of course, now we know why that is. But he gave this speech. He, you know, didn't cry. He didn't break down or anything. I thought the way he handled himself was very impressive. And that could not have been any, I mean, we've seen guys in the ring announce that they were being forced into retirement from wrestling, and they're weeping like a bunch of babies. This guy stood up in front of the world, in front of millions of people, and however many thousand were in that building right in front of him, and made a life-changing announcement that could be life or death for him. And I thought he held it together and did very well. Very few people knew about what he was going to say before he walked out there. It's not believed that he even told Seth Rollins or Dean Ambrose, only told them that he's going out there to relinquish the championship, and hey, you guys should come out and meet me on stage when I'm done. And apparently that is the extent to which they knew what was going on. It was only kept to family, close family, and some executives and writers. The announcers apparently didn't even know exactly what he was going to say beyond, I guess, you know, Michael Cole knowing that he was going to be vacating the title. They didn't know he was sick. And you could tell just by the way Corey Graves and Renee Young looked when they put them on camera right after. They looked like they looked and sounded like they had seen a ghost. And that could not have been an easy thing for them to do. As far as the disease is concerned, and I talked a lot about this in the Sound Off Extra that I did, but just to get into a little bit more here, there are different types of leukemia. Leukemia is not just one very specific disease. You know, there's different forms of it, some more serious than others, although it's serious no matter which version you have. There is chronic, there is acute. What's concerning is that he says he has relapsed. This is his second bout with the disease. That usually means it's more aggressive the second time around. That it somewhat limits his treatment options, depending on exactly which type of leukemia he has. But because it's the second time, there, I'm sure, are some things that maybe are not, like some weapons that are not available to him now that may have been, you know, 10 or 11 years ago when he dealt with this for the first time. Now, I talked about, you know, in that video what my own mother went through. And thank you to everybody who left comments on that video about me sharing that. People seem to appreciate me being able to relay like a personal experience to put a different sort of perspective on this. And it helps sometimes to do that. You know, you talk to somebody who actually went through it themselves, or a friend or a family member went through it, and it just adds a little more perspective to what's going on here. And so I was happy to do that. I mean, well, not happy, I guess, but, you know, I was very much, I very much appreciate the people who left comments about that. But this is not really, at the end of the day, this is not about Roman Reigns, the wrestler, the character. It's about a human being, you know, who came out and he revealed that he is suffering from a life-threatening illness. It's not a work all the people leaving snarky, stupid comments, and some people were offended by that when I even insinuated how dumb it was. Because, hey, this is WWE, would you really put it past them? I get what you're saying, and this company has done a lot of really low shit over the years. You're absolutely right about that. There are just certain situations where you've got to use your brain, and you can kind of look at the situation and say, this is very real. This is not something that's, you know, to joke about, or this is not just some big elaborate storyline to get him cheered. The fact that there are still people, here we are a week later almost, that still buy into that is frightening to me. There are just certain things that are off limits that you just know are not a work. And this is most definitely not. I wish it was. In a way, I wish it was. But no, it is not. He's not going to come out and be a surprise entrant in the Royal Rumble in January. This is a man with a young daughter. He's got 2-year-old twin boys. And that really is the big picture here. You know, wrestling is completely insignificant when it comes to all of that stuff. What he has, can it be cured? It is possible. I've seen things online written by some saying it's not possible to be cured. That is not accurate. That is not accurate. Some types, yes, they cannot be cured. Other types can be. In Roman's case, it's probably a lot less likely, I would think, to be curable, given that it's a recurrence. It's probably a very good chance, even if he beats it, unfortunately, that it could come back again. My mother, for example, she achieved cure status with less than 5% what they call blasts in her bone marrow, because the particular type of leukemia that she had, it was called acute lymphoblastic leukemia. It's actually a leukemia that's more common in young children. And in young children, I think these days, the cure rate for ALL is somewhere between like 90 and 95%. It's very, very high if you're a young child. Although in her case, she was not a young child. She wasn't that old either, but she wasn't a child and she was diagnosed with it. But she was able to get those blasts in the bone marrow, if not completely gone, they were below a certain level. And when that happens, and if that stays consistent over a period of months or years, you achieve cure status. And in her case, it never came back. Now, she developed other cancers because chemo is poison. And they always warn you, this may cause secondary cancers. And you don't really think about it because what the hell can you do? What's the alternative? You know, when you're as sick as she was, and we literally had days to make a decision. That's how close to the end we were. We didn't realize it at the time. Thank God we found the right doctor at the right moment, and almost immediately she went in for treatment, and I went in with her. But it was very touch and go there for a while. But when you're that sick and you get diagnosed with an illness, with any kind of cancer, I mean, what are you supposed to do? You say, well, gee, I don't want a secondary cancer to develop, so I'll just let the primary cancer spread and kill me. Of course not. You do whatever needs to be done. Unfortunately for her, it got her in the end. There's not a doubt in my mind. There is not a doubt in my mind that her, you know, breast cancer, which did not run in our family at all, and her doctor believes this as well. Not a doubt in my mind that, you know, it was caused by the treatment many years earlier for the leukemia. And actually, her first bout with it developed right after she finished years of the maintenance therapy for the leukemia, and then all of a sudden we get a nice surprise. There's not a doubt in my mind that one led to the other. And you know, it's kind of like a horror movie villain. You can beat it, but in the back of your mind, you live with the fear that it's just a matter of when and not if it's going to come back. And I don't doubt that Roman may have been living with those thoughts for many years in the back of his mind. You know, he went through a horrible experience when he was 22 years old, and he overcame it. But in the back of your mind, you live with that fear that one day the other shoe is going to drop, and it's going to come back. And anybody who has dealt with any form of this can attest to having that feeling in the pit of your stomach. Or any family member. If you've had a child or a parent or somebody go through it, you also worry about it. Believe me, you may worry about it even more than they do. Everybody goes through that. Far too many good people have been dealt a very bad hand with cancer. You know, like in my case, I'm fortunate enough that for the time being, you know, in my case with what I have, I mean, I get my counts checked every few months and I take a baby aspirin every day. You know, for the rest of my life, it kind of helps thin the blood. And that's it. Right now, that's all I need to do at the moment. Now, if my platelets get too high, then like little vampires, what they'll have to do is they'll have to stick a needle in me and suck out the blood because my marrow just produces too much of it. And I asked them, I said, how does this happen? When I first got diagnosed, I said, how does this happen? I felt fine. The only reason I even found out about it was because I had some kind of virus and I went to the doctor and they did a blood test and the guy came back and he said, huh. He says, well, you're some of your counts are a little too high. It could just be because you're sick. Come back to me in a month and we'll recheck you. Well, that's a nice thing to worry about for 30 days. 30 days later, I went back and sure enough, they were still at that same level. And you rule out this and that, and then boom, there's your diagnosis. It just happens like that. You don't have to feel sick or anything like that. So in my case, anyway, so I asked one day, I said, how does this happen? And they say, well, you know, it doesn't run in the, it's not a family thing. It's not like, you know, what I have is something that is hereditary as far as anybody knows. It's like a switch that gets flipped one day at random. And there's no way to flip it back. There's no cure, at least not yet. So then you get into questions of prognosis and you just don't want to think about that stuff because there's nothing you could do about it. And it's the same with leukemia in that I'm sure your doctors won't tell you to go gorge on junk food, you know, or go live in unhealthy, go smoke and gorge on junk food. It doesn't really matter how fit you are. It doesn't really matter how much you exercise. These are all very positive things that I would encourage everybody to do, but they don't dictate prognosis. You look at a young guy like Roman Reigns and you think to yourself, how can this man be sick? He was 22 years old when he first was diagnosed. How can a 22-year-old athlete, a football player, be diagnosed with leukemia? Because cancer doesn't care. It doesn't discriminate based on who you are or what you look like or how much money you have. It does not give a shit. And that's what's so scary about it. Now, treatments have evolved over the years since I was familiar with all this stuff. So maybe there are options other than IV chemotherapy. I don't know that a bone marrow transplant or a stem cell transplant in his case would be applicable, given that this is a relapse. But again, every case is different. I got an education in this many years ago, but I didn't get a medical degree. So I don't claim to have all the answers here. I'm just offering my perspective on this. I see a lot of people asking, you know, when is he going to come back? When do you think Roman will be ready to come back? Is he going to be out for 6 months? Is he going to be out for, you know, a year? If he beats it, you know, assuming he beats it, I would love to think that he would be back, later next year, but that's being very optimistic. I think people have this vision of him beating it and just coming back like a month or two later and looking like the Roman Reigns of old. You go through the ringer with this disease. You are not the same person when it's over. And in many cases, they beat down your immune system just to build it back up. So what your body goes through to come back from that, it doesn't happen very quickly. It does not happen overnight. It could be next year. It could be 2020. It could be never. There is a very real possibility that he does not get cleared to come back. That's just a sad reality that he may have to accept. The treatment for this is brutal. It ages you. I don't wish this on anybody. So hopefully he has a strong support system around him because that's as much a part of getting through this thing as anything. I think of those people who have no family, have no friends, and have to go through something like this alone. It's awful. I suspect that's not the case with Roman. But Sonic Hero on YouTube, just to lighten things up a little bit here, said that Roman Reigns is the unluckiest top guy that WWE has ever had. He said 2 years ago, he got hit with a wellness violation and was suspended. That was the suspension that was allegedly for Adderall, although the WWE never made that stuff public. Then last year, his brother died. That was Rosie who passed away. Then he was out with the mumps, and now finally after winning the Universal title, his leukemia comes back. And when you really take a step back and you look at it that way, maybe not lucky, but as charmed a career as Roman has had so far, and that's part of the reason why people, I think, resent him, because he has achieved a lot in a relatively short period of time. But for all of the success that he has had, multiple WrestleMania main events and championships and top guy status, when you really look at it from what Sonic just said, yeah, it's not been easy for this guy. He's been through quite a bit. Samu of the Samoan SWAT team, this kind of plays into that. Samoan SWAT team fame, I got visions of Samu as part of the Headbangers. But now he was part of the Head Shrinkers in WWE. He revealed this week in a Facebook post that he is battling stage 4 liver cancer. And he is waiting on a transplant to save his life. Just last week, this guy's 55 years old. He teamed up with his son on the MLW Fusion TV show in a tag team match. This was just last week. And he also gave an interview last week to Wrestling Inc. and mentioned in the interview how Roman Reigns is his godson. I think they're cousins, but like Roman is his godson. How proud he is of him. And a week later, here we are, all this awful news. It's terrible. It really is. So let's look at the wrestling aspect of this now. He's vacated the Universal Championship. This has been positioned as the top title in the company, even more than the WWE title. That was the match that, well, probably still is, going to headline Crown Jewel over the WWE title match, if there is one, you know, depending on what happens with Daniel Bryan. So now it's going to be Braun Strowman one-on-one with Brock Lesnar. Instead of a triple threat, it'll be one-on-one for the vacant championship to crown a new champion. Braun is back as a babyface. He helped cost Dolph Ziggler and Drew McIntyre the Raw Tag Team titles on Monday night. The heel turn that came at the end of the show, they won the titles. And then Dean Ambrose decided to drop the hammer on Seth Rollins and lay him out with dirty deeds. And he beat him up and beat him up and beat him up. He pulled up the padding from the outside of the ring, gave him a dirty deeds on the concrete floor. He snapped. Dean Ambrose snapped. And there's been a lot said this week by people about this and the timing of it and people calling it tasteless and they shouldn't have done it. Why couldn't they wait a week? I thought what they did here was fantastic. I thought it was great. I thought the timing had to be when it was because you're playing off people's emotions are at a high right now. And this was an inevitable turn. This has been teased and teased for weeks on end. It was going to happen. And they just decided, now's as good a time as any. You want to really hit people in the feels, you do it on this night. And not wait a week or two or three. So I didn't have a problem with it at all. I thought the way it was done was pitch perfect. And for the people calling it tasteless, like what exactly was tasteless about it? He didn't attack Roman. It's not like they had Roman come back out to do one last embrace and then he floored him. Boy, would that have gotten some heat. Why? Because Seth said before the match they were dedicating it to Roman? Is that, you know, we're going to win for Roman? They did win for Roman. That's exactly what they did. They won the match for Roman Reigns. This happened after the match. But it's like funny to me, like people call something like that tasteless. You think that's tasteless. You must be new here. WWE has done a metric ton of tasteless shit over the years. This barely even qualifies, as far as I'm concerned. You're entitled to your opinion, but I think people were just looking, they're looking to be offended by something. That's what it felt like to me. So I thought it was very well done. Now the question becomes what happens with the tag team titles. I assume the tag team titles, much like the Universal title now, will be vacated. That would be my assumption anyway. Maybe not. Maybe I don't think it's a guarantee that Rollins is going to come out on TV this week and be angry and looking. It could be one of those things where he comes out and he's willing to forgive his brother. He comes out and he says, look, we were all pent up with emotion last week given what was going on. And Seth, of all people, knows what it's like to turn his back on his fellow S.H.I.E.L.D. brothers. So maybe he comes out and he's actually understanding. And he wants to give Dean the chance to come out and clear the air. They could go down that road where, you know, Rollins is not so quick to abandon Dean. He's still hoping for a reconciliation. So maybe they won't vacate the titles right away, you know? Or maybe they'll do a deal where Ambrose is at least willing to listen, and there's a rematch, and it's the old Hogan-Sid thing from Saturday Night's Main Event back in 92, where Seth ends up working the entire match, goes for the tag, and Ambrose hops down off the apron. And they lose the titles back to Drew and Dolph. It could be something like that as well. It would make sense, though, in the end of all this, to somehow get those belts on AOP. They have been positioning AOP as this dominant tag team on Raw. They could only beat job guys so many times. At some point, they've got to win a big match, and the thing for them to do, I would think, would be to take the tag team titles and let them go on a monster run as the champions for a while. So you've got to find a way to get those belts. It could be that's the match they make. Maybe they do Rollins and Ambrose against AOP, and it's in the match with AOP that Ambrose turns his back on Rollins again, and Rollins is outnumbered 2-on-1, and AOP beats him, and they win the tag team titles. Maybe we'll see that on Raw tomorrow night. But it kind of makes sense if you try to make sense of why Dean would turn. They've been teasing it for weeks that he's sort of the redheaded stepchild of the group, and Roman had a belt, and Seth is the Intercontinental Champion, and Dean was the one without a title, and yeah, you could go down that. It's a very basic storyline. You can certainly play off that. Somebody else made the suggestion. I can't take credit for it. I thought it was kind of a neat perspective on things that, you know, Dean turned on Seth. He didn't turn on Roman. He and Roman were always came off as being very close. And it goes all the way back to the first turn. Ambrose never forgave Seth Rollins for it. And with all these things happening lately, and Dolph and people like him getting in Dean's head, it made him realize that, you know, now that Roman is gone, now that Roman has to take a leave of absence, and it's just Ambrose and Rollins, I don't want to be with this guy. I was supportive of all this for Roman. Now that Roman's out of the picture, you and I, we're not brothers. So that would be an interesting way to sort of take the story, I think, if they wanted to. Now, of the two, Strowman should win this match at Crown Jewel to set up Drew McIntyre as his first challenger, while Ambrose, in the meantime, can feud with Seth Rollins over the next few months. You know, I got a mailbag question this week from Seth in Norfolk, Virginia, who floated the idea of Brock and Braun going to a no contest at the pay-per-view, which would leave the title vacant, and then 20 years after we did the Deadly Game tournament at Survivor Series, they do another tournament to crown a new champion at Survivor Series this year. It's almost set up to be a very identical situation. If you remember, the WWF title was held up after the triple threat match with Steve Austin, Kane, and The Undertaker in September of 98. And there was a match, actually, at Judgment Day between Undertaker and Kane. Austin was the referee, and he just stunnered both guys, laid them out. So they had this match, but there was no winner. It was basically a no contest. So the championship remained vacant for another month, month and a half, whatever it was, until they got to the Deadly Game tournament. Well, they don't even have to wait that long, because Survivor Series is only a few weeks away. Yes, they could do that. They could have a situation where Brock and Braun do not go to a decisive winner, although that would be a pretty shitty finish if that match goes on last. And they keep the title vacant a few more weeks. I wonder if there's enough time to even build up a big tournament like that. But I'm intrigued by the idea. I like the idea. But again, back in 98 when they did it, you had one title and the entire roster was available to you. That was a 16-man bracket. Actually, it might have been 32. There was a lot of guys in that tournament, including guys who had no business competing for the top championship. Now, these days, you have two titles, and you would end up eating up most of the roster on the Raw side just for the tournament at Survivor Series, unless you had most of the matches on TV and you just build to the finals on pay-per-view. I just find that to be so lame when they do that. I'd rather they boil it down to an 8-man bracket. You could have qualifying matches on TV, boil it down to an 8-man bracket, and do the whole tournament from first round through semis through final in one night, like they used to do with the King of the Ring. The first 3 years of the King of the Ring pay-per-view, they did the entire tournament, pretty much, in one night. That's part of why I love King of the Ring 93 so much, because Bret Hart, it felt like he went through the ringer that night, right? He had to wrestle Razor, then he had to wrestle Perfect, then he had to wrestle Bam Bam. Now imagine if they just did these matches on TV and at the pay-per-view, they just put Bret Hart against Bam Bam Bigelow. I'm sure it would have been a good match still, but it wouldn't have felt as, I don't know, sort of epic, I guess, as a younger wrestling fan. It felt like this guy had really earned it. And that's one of the things I miss about doing the full tournament in one night, and it's a lot more manageable with an 8-man bracket. I would not advise doing that with a 16-person bracket. That's just too much. But you don't even need to go back 20 years to find a similar situation. Just go back 3 years to the Survivor Series in 2015. Seth Rollins had been the, what was he? What was it at the time? The Unified World Champion, it was, I think. The WWE World Heavyweight title. That's what it was. And he got hurt. So they had to vacate the championship and they held a tournament. And at the pay-per-view, they had the two semifinal matches with Roman Reigns and Dean Ambrose both advancing to the finals. Reigns won. And then Sheamus came out. He cashed in his money in the bank to win the title. Now it's Roman who has vacated the title. And you could build to an Ambrose-Rollins match in the finals. Or if it's too soon, if you want to really take your time and tease the match without doing it right away, you could, you know, tease that both guys are in the tournament. And if they advance, it could be Ambrose-Rollins in the finals. But then only Seth advances, right? And maybe Ambrose gets DQ'd or something in his match. And we get a Seth Rollins-Drew McIntyre final for the championship. Ambrose then costs Seth the match. So now all of a sudden you have a situation where it could be the old Bret Hart-Owen Hart dynamic. When Owen first was turning on Bret, Bret didn't want to have any part of it. He would not accept the fact that his little brother wanted to fight him. He wouldn't fight him. He wanted to make peace with him, which he did until Owen kicked his leg out of his leg. And that sort of woke up Bret Hart, and finally he said, I'm going to wrestle my brother. I'm going to do the one thing I said I would never do. Could even go the similar route here. Seth comes out on TV starting this week, and again, maybe he's just not willing to accept what happened here. He's willing to make excuses and say that he had a mental break or whatever. You and I, though, we're brothers, we're friends, we got to stick together. And maybe this just goes on for a few weeks, and it isn't until Survivor Series when Ambrose costs him the championship in the finals that finally wakes up Seth Rollins, and the two of them can go on to have this very personal, like, blood feud. In the meantime, Drew McIntyre wins the championship. And so coming out of this awful situation with Roman Reigns, you've at least now established a new young guy who's never been in this position before as the champion, and you just run with McIntyre and see how he does. See how he does in the role. Because then you can have Rollins programmed with Ambrose, and the logical first opponent for Drew to defend his title against would be Dolph Ziggler. You can just get that out of the way. That's not exactly a program that I think would light the world on fire, but you got to do that match if you're going to do this idea. So, you know, there you go. And now, it can't be Braun Strowman. Because here's the thing about Braun Strowman. What are you going to do? Have him lose again? If we go with this tournament idea that people seem to be, you know, bandying about, that's all well and good, but that implies that Braun is not going to win the championship on Friday. After all the other matches, all the other opportunities that he's had to win the championship, and he's fallen short, the guy won Money in the Bank. He won Money in the Bank and still could not close the deal and win the championship. So that's the only thing. You get to a point where it's sort of the law of diminishing returns with Braun Strowman. How many times is this guy expected to lose and not win the big one before people just completely lose faith in him? You know, that's the risk that you run. You've got to weigh the pros and cons of that. But I do like the tournament idea. And the way I would play it out, I think you could really put McIntyre over big time in that scenario. I do think Roman being out for a while is going to be a very big opportunity to, you know, for others to step up in a way that they would not have been able to before, because Vince McMahon is just so fixated on having one main guy, you know, and in a way, the chickens are coming home to roost now on that, because this just goes to show you that you never know what might happen. Things can change in an instant. All it takes is one injury, one accident, one life-threatening disease, one poorly worded tweet, any number of things. And all of a sudden, you're looking for a new face for your company. This guy that they've been building for 5 or 6 years, grooming for this spot, is gone. What do you do? Are they prepared? Do they have a backup plan? Do they have an A and a B? Who's the B? This is why in the past I have said on this podcast, it would make more sense for this company to build heavily around 2 or 3 people. Maybe 4. 2 on each brand. Top baby faces. And not put all of their eggs in one basket. So that if something like this happens, you've at least got one other person ready to go. And maybe that's Rollins. Maybe it's Ambrose. Ambrose wouldn't be the babyface, but it doesn't feel like there's another guy who has been, you know, positioned as strongly as Roman. I guess Strowman would be the closest thing. And even Strowman, I think, has been diminished a bit over the last, you know, several weeks. That was the nature of what they felt they had to do because Roman was the babyface and we need to turn Braun heel because we're not going to turn Roman. And so, again, you're in this situation where they're kind of stuck. And I'm sure they're in the middle of meetings now every day and they're trying to figure things out going forward in a WWE without Roman Reigns. You know, Roman Reigns, what is it now with Roman? 4, 5 straight WrestleMania main events consecutively? That won't be the case this year. I don't think that should be the case any year. The days of Hulk Hogan headlining 7 of the first 8 WrestleManias, and you could even argue 8 since he factored into the finish at WrestleMania 4, those days need to be over. Nobody should have a stranglehold on that spot or on the main event anymore, I don't think. You need to have more variety. Maybe this could serve as a wake-up call for this company. They invested a lot in this guy, and now they have to find somebody else. Maybe it's somebody from NXT. They happen to have somebody down in NXT right now, who they just signed, who I think could be a huge babyface on the main roster. And his name is Matt Riddle. Aleister Black is another fine choice as well. But the key here is that injury presents opportunity. You need a new top babyface on that Raw roster. And I think even a guy like a Riddle or a Black could be that guy. My point is, he should not be the only guy. And that's the bigger point. Outside of the beginning and the end of that Raw show last week, nothing of any great note happened other than Elias seemingly being turned babyface. After a win over Apollo Crews, he was on stage getting ready to perform when Baron Corbin interrupted. He said, "If Stephanie McMahon didn't like you so much, I'd have fired you by now." And Elias did leave, but then he came back and he smashed his guitar right across Corbin's back. This felt like a rushed deal, maybe because of the Roman Reigns stuff. Elias is over right now, so I think he'll do well as a babyface. I could see him with the Intercontinental title, but they'll have to first get it off Seth Rollins and onto a heel so that he could win it off that person. Now, timing may not be ideal because it's probably going to be Ambrose and Rollins going at it. And it may be Dean Ambrose becoming the IC champion. And of the two, it should absolutely be Ambrose over Elias. I think you could, you know, do more with heel Dean Ambrose. But at some point, I could definitely see Elias as a face holding the IC title. And, you know, just figuring out, you know, who he could work with. It's a weird thing. Like, you know, it's too bad they dropped the ball so badly with Bobby Roode. I mean, Roode's not done much on his own to get me excited since he got called up. But he hasn't had much to work with. He's so boring as a babyface. I'd rather sit through one of those 6-hour defensive driving classes than watch any Bobby Roode segment from the past 6 months. But if he turns on Chad Gable soon, and it sure seems like he's going to, and they let him show some more personality the way he did in NXT, he could be also a candidate for the IC title. He could be the perfect foil or perfect opponent for Elias. And so you could have a babyface Elias feuding with a heel Bobby Roode over the IC title. That could be a program at some point too. But speaking of wasted talent, sad tweet this week goes to Scott Dawson of The Revival. He posted this on Tuesday. He said, "This week on Main Event, it's Bobby Roode and Chad Gable versus Dash and myself, as long as it's not heavily edited. It's a great match that exemplifies what tag team wrestling is all about. Don't give up on us yet. There's a reason that we're called The Revival. You know your booking has been atrocious when you need to plead with people, do not give up on us yet. Monday Night Raw is in dire need of a revival, not Dash and Dawson. But back to Crown Jewel, real quick, I just figured, you know, I just realized the show is on Friday, and since this, I guess, is the last podcast I'm doing before the show, if I'm going to do predictions, I may as well just spit them out real quick right now. But this just goes to show you how ridiculous this is. Two pay-per-views so close together. I don't think in all the years that I've done this podcast, and next weekend it's 11 years, I don't think I've ever done WWE pay-per-view predictions for two different pay-per-views on the same podcast. I talked about Evolution earlier, and now here we are with Crown Jewel. It's just completely, just ridiculous. But as I said, I think Braun Strowman should win. I think he will win, so I'll pick him in the Universal title match. AJ Styles against Daniel Bryan, if the match even happens. I don't think AJ is losing the championship, so maybe it's some kind of funny finish, but he's not losing that belt. Shawn Michaels makes his return to the ring. Oh, by the way, Shawn Michaels is back after an 8.5 year hiatus. He's coming back. I feel like this should be a much bigger deal than it is. He's teaming up with Triple H to take on The Undertaker and Kane. I'm going to pick The Undertaker and Kane here in this match since Triple H got the win over Undertaker. The Brothers of Destruction have to get their win back, and I figure it leads to a singles match probably between Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker, because I assume that's what we're going to get. We're going to get another Shawn Michaels-Undertaker match. New Day against The Bar for the SmackDown Tag Team titles. The Bar is going to retain. And then we have the World Cup, U.S. Open, call it whatever you will. It's all Americans here. We have Kurt Angle against The Miz in round one. I'll go with Kurt Angle. John Cena against Rey Mysterio. Although, that also depends on Cena's status. As of right now, he's off the show, according to different websites. So we'll see who they replace him with if he is bounced out of the tournament. But I think either way, Rey Mysterio should win. Even if Cena goes to Crown Jewel, I pick Rey Mysterio to win. Another first round match, Seth Rollins against Randy Orton. I'm picking Randy Orton. And Jeff Hardy against Dolph Ziggler. I'm going to go with Dolph Ziggler. So that would leave us with Kurt Angle, Rey Mysterio, Randy Orton, and Dolph Ziggler. Two babyfaces, two heels. Who do I think is going to win this World Cup? I think Randy Orton is going to win. Now, if you're wondering where the hell Samoa Joe is, he's been out injured. He's injured yet again. I don't know what the injury is. It might be a knee injury, but he is hurt. Look, I'm a fan of Joe. You guys know that. But he has been hurt so much, it seems. I completely understand why WWE would not want to put the championship on him. I hate to say it. But when you get hurt this much, at that age, that's a big red flag. And it sucks. It's probably just age catching up with him. The guy's almost 40 years old. I mean, AJ Styles is 41, and, you know, but AJ Styles has a very different body than Samoa Joe. So, you know, you can't necessarily compare the two. Joe's got a lot of miles on that body. He had a lot of wars over the years, going back to the Ring of Honor days. And then, of course, all the years he spent in TNA. But it just sucks. It really does. I have absolutely nothing to say about SmackDown this week. Other than we had almost 60% of you in our Twitter poll vote did not watch. And it was mirrored in the ratings, because SmackDown did one of its lowest ratings ever since going live. But thank God 60% of you people did not watch this show. I thought SmackDown sucked this week. But I also thought it was very telling, very odd, to end your go-home show to your first ever women's pay-per-view with a Randy Orton-Jeff Hardy main event. I just think that says, it says a lot about how they feel about this Evolution show going into it. On a more positive note, I don't want to be, God, there's so much negative news this week, illnesses and injuries. But let's lighten things up a little bit here. I watched the Falls Count Anywhere main event from 205 Live this week between Mustafa Ali and Hideo Itami. I thought that it was, I was going to say the best, I would say the second best match I saw on WWE television all week after the Tony Storm-Mako Satomura match on the Mae Young Classic. But what a finish to this match, too. Ali hit a 450 splash off the top rope through a table out on the floor where Hideo Itami was laying. He was stretched out on the table. He nailed this 450. That table broke dead in half, pinned him on the floor. Hell of a way for that match to end. I know Hideo did not exactly pan out the way a lot of people hoped he would in WWE, but Mustafa Ali, I've talked him up before. I'll do it again here. This guy's got a big future, and not in the cruiserweight division. I'm talking main roster, Raw or SmackDown, mixing it up with the top guys. This guy is so much fun to watch. He is just very, very good. This was a great match, and it's worth a watch if you didn't see it, which was probably most of you, I'm guessing. So definitely go back and check that out. On NXT this week, the mystery was solved on who attacked Aleister Black. Or was it? Or was it? Could there still be a twist here in this story? They had William Regal out there. He was in the ring to make an announcement concerning the championship match at TakeOver War Games. We had Tommaso Ciampa, the champ himself, come out. And it was the parade of people who came out. Velveteen Dream came out. Lars Sullivan came out. And so you have all these guys out there. And then Nikki Cross comes out. And Nikki Cross is in the ring. She's confronting Tommaso Ciampa. Aleister Black, meanwhile, a very angry, enraged Aleister Black, arrives at the building. They show him coming into the building. He roundhouse kicks one of the security guys in the face. Him coming in the way he did come through the back door like that kind of reminded me of when Austin, that night that he came back to the WWE. Remember that? The whole big brawl in the ring with all the WCW, ECW guys. And Vince McMahon was trying all night to just convince Stone Cold, we need your help. And he was shooting pool or something. And he came to the arena. He beat the hell out of people as he came into the building. That kind of reminded me of that a little bit here. On a much, much, much smaller scale, obviously. So he's just kicking the shit out of people. He comes in, storms into the ring, and he goes right up to William Regal, grabs him by his lapel. He's asking, where is he? Where is he? And as soon as he turns around, Johnny Gargano is there, and he hits Black with a super kick. And then he picks up the microphone. He says, I'm right here. And the people booed as they went off the air. And so it appears as though Johnny Gargano has just revealed himself to be the attacker for Aleister Black. Tommaso Ciampa tweeted, sometimes you just have to DIY. With a tear in my eye, Big Daddy Ciampa is proud. And he posted a longer statement on his social media that it's just perfect, you know, the way that they're playing this whole thing. And it's like Ciampa now has so much respect for Gargano and what he did. And I always knew he had it in him. So is Gargano the attacker? It was never outright said that he was, and it looks that way, but I'm not admitting defeat just yet on this with Cassius Ohno, because Cassius Ohno was my pick as far as the attacker. I'm not willing to concede defeat just yet. He could still have something to do with this. Maybe he was an accomplice. And I say this because you had Nikki Cross on this very same show earlier in the night, backstage. After Cassius had wrestled a match, she confronted Cassius Ohno backstage and said, I know what you did. I know what you did, she said. Kind of makes me think he's got some kind of connection to this. But I don't mind the Gargano turn. One person asked me, he goes, oh, what'd you think of the Gargano turn? Isn't it stupid? He's such a great babyface. You know what? He's already kind of been a heel for months now. They've been straddling the line with him for a long time. I trust where they're going with these stories. You know, it's a trust I would not have on Raw or SmackDown in a story like this. I don't mind it at all. Yes, he is a great babyface, but this was a nice little twist. And I think that maybe we end up getting some sort of twisted pseudo DIY reunion. Even if it's just Regal making a match, a one-time match at some point with Gargano and Ciampa as partners, against Aleister Black and Velveteen Dream, who have a history together themselves. That is a match I would like to see. And that could be, I mean, I guess it would probably end up being like a random television main event and not like a takeover match or anything like that, but that would be a match I would like to see. That would be a cool match, I think. But that makes four turns on WWE television this week if you count Elias and Braun Strowman, Dean Ambrose, and now Johnny Gargano. This is all coming off recent heel turns for Lashley and Big Show. I promise they have not given me the book. They have not given me the book. I know I talk about turns all the time, but they have not given me the book here on this product. But that is a lot of turns. I would not trust anybody. If I worked in that company right now, I'd have eyes in the back of my head. I wouldn't. DTA. I might be DTF too, but DTA. Don't trust anybody. Takeover. I blame the alcohol for that little hiccup there. Takeover card here now becomes a little bit clearer coming out of this show. It looks as though we might be getting a match between Johnny Gargano and Aleister Black. That would seem to me an obvious match on that card. Ciampa against the Velveteen Dream for the NXT Championship. Possibly with Lars Sullivan. They might turn it into a triple threat match. And the Undisputed Era in a War Games match, I would think, now that you got Bobby Fish is back, you can have all four members of the Undisputed Era in the double ring War Games match against the War Raiders, probably Ricochet, and I think Pete Dunne. Right? Pete Dunne, Ricochet, and the War Raiders make four. So that, to me, would seem like the War Games match. You also need to have a women's title match. I'm thinking if Kairi retains at Evolution tonight, it should be Bianca Belair next. If Shayna Baszler regains the championship tonight, I don't see Bianca Belair unless they make it a triple threat. And so it could end up being Kairi Sane, Bianca Belair, and Shayna Baszler, I guess, is a road they could go down if they wanted to somehow worm Belair into that title match. Because she was on the show this week, Bianca was, crowing at William Regal backstage. I'm undefeated, right? She said that over and over again. I'm undefeated. I want a championship match. I'm undefeated. So they're already teasing that she's going to get a championship match. It's just a matter of when. So that would probably leave, what's that, four matches that would make? That would make four. Usually they have five on these takeover shows. And so Cassius Ohno challenging someone like a Keith Lee or a Matt Riddle. Since Cassius has been talking about, you know, being the gatekeeper, send me all your new guys, I'll mow them down, I'll knock them out. The two newest guys are Keith Lee. And Matt Riddle's actually making his NXT debut this week on television. So if they want to get him on the card, that could be the fifth match. And there you go. That's your takeover card. Looks like a great card. Mae Young Classic. Speaking of great, I'm really sad this thing is over. This was the final show. The finals of the tournament take place at Evolution tonight. So the final Mae Young Classic episode aired this past week. I want to make a correction first. Last week when I was talking about Tegan Knox's injury, I said that she was from Australia. She is not from Australia. She is actually from Wales. And a lot of people corrected me on that, so I apologize for that. We had Toni Storm one-on-one with Mako Satomura. This was my favorite WWE match of the week, even more than the False Count Anywhere match on 205 Live, although go out and watch both would be my recommendation. This was just a hard-hitting, well-worked match. A lot of fun. The crowd was in. It's always nice to have the fans invested in it. And by the end, they were going nuts. This felt like a big-time match. And a lot of that had to do with the way the fans were reacting. They had these fans in the palm of their hand here in this match. A lot of near falls. Toni hit Storm Zero. Mako kicked out. Mako hit some of her trademark kicks. Toni kicked out. And finally, in the end, Toni was able to hit a second Storm Zero and pick up the win. And so Toni Storm advances to the finals, and she was in tears. She hugged Mako. It was this great moment. And Triple H came out on stage. He raised Mako's arm, and so this was. And then they let Toni cut a promo after the match, which was also very good. So Toni has now beaten Hiroyo Matsumoto and Mako Satomura in this tournament. She has been the Japanese Slayer. She's got one more to go in Io Shirai if she wants to win the whole thing, which I think she will. Let me just say this about Mako. She was, to this tournament, what Kota Ibushi was to the Cruiserweight Classic. She was the MVP of this tournament. And I hope we get to see more of her at some point. I don't believe she signed with WWE, It'll probably be like a Coda situation. He came in and he went right out. And I think that's probably the same with Mako. But hopefully they'll bring her back for a special match or two. You know, like a takeover card here and there. The other semifinal was Io Shirai against Rhea Ripley. These two probably had very little time to put this match together. I believe this was taped the same night that the Tegan Nox injury occurred. Tegan Nox was originally earmarked to be Io's opponent and possibly even go on to win the entire thing. And so they had to change plans. They still had a good match. I didn't think it was close to the opener, but they still had a good match. Io does this absolutely crazy suicide dive that she's gonna kill herself one day. Hopefully not, but she hit the suicide dive here in this match and you know, hit a 619 missile drop kick for a near fall. Rhea Ripley, for her part, handled herself very well. She's still very young and very new to this, and she's coming along, you know, really nicely. She's gonna be a solid heel on that, you know, at least the NXT roster one day soon. But in the end, Shirai hit the double knees in the corner. Actually hit the moonsault. She still missed most of it, but she hit the moonsault better than I've seen her hit it in recent memory. And she picked up the win. So we have a final of Io Shirai and Toni Storm, the match that I am most looking forward to on that Evolution card tonight, and neither of whom are main roster talents. Lucha Underground. I didn't have a chance to review it last week, so I wanted to make sure I mentioned it this week. This was another one of those one-match shows that we sometimes see them do. They've had all-night-long matches, which is their version of an Iron Man match. And they've done Aztec Warfare matches, excuse me, which sometimes will take up the entire length. Actually, I think most of the time when they do the Aztec Warfare, it takes up the full length of the episode. And that's what happened here in the 7-2 Survive match for the Gift of the Gods Championship. It was Jake Strong, King Cuerno, Big Bad Steve, Hernandez, Aerostar, PJ Black, and Dante Fox competing for the championship. This was good. I would say this was probably the weakest of those types of one-match shows that I've seen Lucha Underground do. Which is not to say it was bad, but it was the weakest. The highlights of this were pretty much anything Dante Fox did. And also Drago. Drago came out to the ring in the middle of this match with a forklift, dressed as a construction worker. He even had little holes in the top of his helmet so that his little devil horns can fit through. He looked like a member of the Village People out there. He lifted his buddy Aerostar up on a platform with this forklift. Up, 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 all the way into the air. High into the air. Higher than the balcony, even. And Aerostar did a giant dive off the platform down onto King Cuerno, and I think he ended up pinning Big Bad Steve. Match came down to Dante Fox and Jake Strong. They kept Strong looking the strongest in this match, pun intended. He got Dante to tap out to the ankle lock to win the match and the Gift of the Gods Championship. Then he broke Dante's ankle. They played those awful celery stick sound effects again at the end here to show you that he broke the guy's ankle. And so, as quickly as Dante returned to the temple, Dante is likely now gone from the temple. Lucha Underground giveth, Lucha Underground taketh away. Show closed with Johnny Mundo training for his Ultima Lucha match with Matanza. Aerostar was there. And he told Johnny, pretty much, look, you can't beat Matanza by yourself, dude. You just don't stand a chance. At that point, Drago flew in. He obviously clocked out from his construction gig. And he brought with him the Nintendo Power Glove that we haven't seen in a while here. The gauntlet that Cage had in his possession last season, that King Cuerno had stolen. Aerostar gave the glove to Johnny to help him fight off Matanza. When Johnny put the thing on, he said it made him feel like a god. I'm thinking Matanza's days on this show are probably numbered. In fact, this could very well be his last match in Lucha Underground. He still has a spot on my list of one of the great wrestling debuts of all time. And please don't ask me to rank them. I've already ranked them. I don't remember the episode number, but I've absolutely ranked the best debuts in the past. I know I have. And typically, Kane is always at the top of my list and probably always will be. I just think the way that whole, from the planning of it and the teasing of it to the actual debut itself in the main event of a pay-per-view, I don't think you'll find a better debut, especially for like a monster character, than Kane. But Matanza is up there. Matanza is pretty high up on the list. So that's what I'll remember his character for. Part one of Ultima Lucha Cuatro begins this Wednesday, meaning we only have two episodes left. It's a two-parter, so part one is this week. Hopefully one of my Lucha Underground friends, if they're listening, can slide into my DMs and clue me in as to what the status is of a fifth season. I don't know if anything's already been taped, if it's in the can. I don't know if they've even been told when it might be, if it hasn't been taped yet. Are things in limbo again? I would love to know. So if anybody can clue me in, please do so. Let's get to your mailbag questions. If you have questions, you can always email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. Oh, my poor voice here. We're in the home stretch here. We're almost done. My throat is on fire right now. Dalton on Twitter asked if I could do a top 10 list of Eddie Guerrero's best matches, since he is a very big Eddie Guerrero fan. We're actually coming up next month on 13 years since Eddie passed away. I told him I would, and so I thought about it. I put together what I believe are 10 of the very best Eddie Guerrero matches. Now, there are way more than 10 matches that you could choose from. Probably a lot of matches in Mexico and Japan that even I'm not thinking of. But these are the ones on my list. These are not ranked in order of quality. This is only date order. But this is my list. Number one is the When Worlds Collide tag team match. It was Hair vs. Mask from 1994, where him and Love Machine Art Barr were paired up. That is a classic match, an excellent match. There was a 2 out of 3 falls match that I saw. I don't remember if it was on the ECW DVD or not. It was on one of these. I could have sworn it was on a WWE DVD. I definitely remember seeing it a few years ago. And it was a great match from ECW. 2 out of 3 falls. Eddie Guerrero against Dean Malenko. 1995, I believe it was. Eddie Guerrero and Chris Jericho had a great Cruiserweight Championship match at the WCW Fall Brawl pay-per-view back in 1997. Later that same year is the classic match. Maybe the best match of Eddie's career. The one he had with Rey Mysterio at Halloween Havoc. I don't see how you can do an Eddie Guerrero top 5, let alone a top 10, and not have that match on there. Eddie and RVD, Rob Van Dam, they had a ladder match for the Intercontinental title on Raw back in 2002, I believe it was. That was the match where the idiot fan in like the Oilers jersey, I think it was, jumped in the ring. And Eddie was climbing the ladder and this freaking drunk asshole ran into the ring and shoved the ladder. That could have ended in disaster. And all I remember, Eddie definitely threw a punch at the guy, but I think it was Earl Hebner who literally just like took down this guy. He just grabbed him and took him down. And RVD, what I remember about this most of all is as this is going on, there's this commotion in the ring. They show RVD laying on the mat and he's got this like literally stoned look on his face, which is so appropriate. He just looks up like, hey, what's going on, man? It's like all dazed and confused. He's got no idea what's going on. Number 6, Eddie Guerrero against Edge during the SmackDown 6 era. This was from September 2002. They had a, I think it was a no disqualification match on SmackDown. Number 7, Eddie Guerrero and Chris Benoit for the United States Championship. It was the finals of the U.S. title tournament at Vengeance 2003. They had a great match. There was a parking lot brawl on SmackDown in the same year with John Cena that Eddie had. That was pretty good. If you go back and watch, it was a long time. I went back and watched it again. It had been a while, and it was a very unique concept. I wish we would see more things like that on WWE television. Not parking lot brawls per se, just, you know, unique matches. Eddie Guerrero and Kurt Angle from WrestleMania 20 is on my list at number 9. And number 10, rounding out the list, and again, this is in date order. I cannot stress that enough. This is not ranked. But number 10, Eddie Guerrero and Brock Lesnar from No Way Out 2004. An excellent match those two had, full of emotion, of course, at the very end. And even with the Goldberg run-in, you know, Goldberg getting involved, just a great match. And what a moment for Eddie at the end, celebrating with the championship, diving into the crowd. And it's just a great moment, a great capper to a great match. The last great match of his career. The matches with JBL, you know, that bloodbath they had, it Judgment Day a few months later in 2004. It really wasn't a great match. I thought about putting that on my list, and I said, you know, am I putting it on the list because it was a great match, or am I putting it on the list because it was a freaking bloodbath? And I said, I would be putting it on there because of the blood. If you take the blood out of it, I don't think it's really all that great of a match. But it wasn't terrible either, you know, and I mean, it's freaking JBL in a pay-per-view main event for the first time. So Eddie, you know, look, Eddie went above and beyond. I know Eddie was friendly with him, and he went above and beyond for the guy, and he hit an artery, and my God, I've never seen so much blood in my life. And I think he either passed out later or he was in shock. They had to take him to the hospital. Ugh, my God. It was awful. But I do think that the match with Brock was the last truly what I would call great match that Eddie had in his career. Chris, from Wappinger Falls, New York, can you tell me about the Collision in Korea event in 1995 with WCW and New Japan Pro Wrestling? Nobody ever talks about it. It never came out on VHS, and it didn't even show on cable until 2 months after the event took place. Why is the show kept so secret, and do you know of any horror stories from the event? Well, I think New Japan may own the rights to the show, which is why it's not on the WWE Network. I have no idea if it's on New Japan World. It was a joint show, as you said, brokered by Antonio Inoki and Eric Bischoff, with WCW talent and New Japan talent. And Inoki at the time, I think he was in, this was back when he was in the government, I think, at the time, and he was trying to engineer better relations between the Japanese and the North Koreans. And so this was one event that was hosted as part of this big peace festival that the North Koreans were hosting. Muhammad Ali was there. Bischoff came over with Ric Flair and the Steiner brothers. I think Chris Benoit wrestled on that show under a mask as the Pegasus Kid or Wild Pegasus or whatever name he was using. Flair and Inoki wrestled in the main event on night two. They had something like 150,000 fans, supposedly, each night in the stadium. It was over 300,000 people both nights, if you assume that the second night was a completely different set of 150,000. We don't really know exactly who was in that crowd, although I think it's safe to say nobody probably paid to be there. I think it was more that they were told to be there. But as far as any horror stories, it was more just, you know, Bischoff and Flair in particular, I've heard in interviews talk about how intimidating it was. You know, they had government officials there to greet them on the tarmac when they got off the plane. And the first thing they did was they took their passports away from them. So imagine flying to another country, let alone North frickin' Korea, okay? Or even some third world country somewhere. And imagine the first thing that happens when you step off the plane is you have, you know, security people with guns or something asking for your passports and confiscating them from you. That would probably be the first sign that this might have been a bad idea. So I've heard them talk about that. I heard there's a classic Scott Norton story. I guess Scott Norton was there too. Although I don't know at the time if he would have been there on behalf of New Japan or WCW because he worked for both of them. But Scott Norton was there. And Ric Flair tells this story, actually. This might have been in his book. Maybe that's where I remember it from. But Norton was on the phone like at the hotel with his wife. Like he called home. And he was talking to his wife, and I guess he didn't like the trip. He didn't like something. And all of a sudden, his phone went dead. They cut his phone off. It's pretty scary stuff. Big Brother was watching them very closely from the moment they landed. But even when they landed, you know, after they took the passports away from them, they separated them into groups. They took them to different hotels. I mean, put yourself in that position. How would you feel? You probably would be a little worried, I think. At that point, they wanted Flair to make a statement. When this whole thing was over, they wanted Ric Flair to make a statement about how great his time was there and how, you know, now I see the North Koreans as someone who can dominate the U.S. if they wanted to. And he got around that somehow. Flair said he wasn't going to make that statement. I don't know what he said, but, you know, it's every bit as bad as what WWE is getting heat for now with the Saudis. You know, only back then you didn't have social media. It just sort of flew under the radar. If they tried something like that today, believe me, the reaction would be very different. Matthew says, rewatching NXT TakeOver Toronto, I remember how over Bobby Roode, Ty Dillinger, the Authors of Pain, Revival, Asuka, Samoa Joe, and Nakamura were. And that was just 2 years ago. Can you name anybody under the NXT banner who is a bigger star since being called up to the main roster? Absolutely. I can name a bunch. If you don't count all three members of the Shield, since they would have technically started in FCW, you don't even need to include the Shield guys. You could still have Kevin Owens. I mean, Kevin Owens didn't spend a lot of time in NXT, but he passed through. I'd say he went on to become a bigger star. Elias is the name that really sticks out to me. Elias, I did not care at all for Elias. Elias had, you know what Elias had with me? He had CJ Parker heat with me when he was in NXT. I couldn't stand CJ Parker. Couldn't stand him. And he went on to great success as Juice Robinson. So he's, and that's cool that he went on to live his dream, working in Japan and winning the U.S. title, even though he lost it. And he's doing very well for himself. Elias, though, I thought, I can't stand this guy. He comes out, he's got go-away heat with me. And then even when he came to the main roster, I didn't care much. I have warmed to Elias, and you can't deny that Elias is a much bigger star now than he was in NXT. He is a success story. Now, how far they go with him, I don't know. They just turned him babyface. I think, like I said earlier, he could be an IC champion at some point. I don't know that he's going to go much higher than that. But he's absolutely a bigger star. And moreover, than he was in NXT. Alexa Bliss. I don't believe Alexa Bliss won the women's title, and somebody will correct me if I'm wrong. I don't remember her winning the women's title in NXT. Maybe she did. I don't think she did. And since coming to the main roster, look at how many championships this girl has won. Like 5 or 6 different titles and a Money in the Bank match. So, it's easy to point to all the examples of guys that should have done better on the main roster, or were buried, or whatever, and you can blame their failure, at least in part, on WWE creative. But it's not like NXT, it's not like there haven't been a decent number of success stories also. People who actually did go on to become bigger stars on the main roster. It absolutely has happened. It just should happen more often than it does. Anthony from Chicago, what did you think of Palmer Cannon? I am reminded of him recently from a shoot that Nova did on Hannibal's YouTube channel and how he was chased away from the company by JBL. Yeah, Hannibal does some great shoot interviews. He did one recently with Duke the Dumpster Drozzi that's pretty insightful. And Sid, he interviewed Sid Vicious as well. I didn't know much. When he debuted, I did not know much about Palmer Cannon. This is going back to like 2005 now, SmackDown, I think. I didn't know much about him other than when he showed up as this representative of the network. That was his gimmick. I always thought, Cyrus the Virus did it first and did it better in ECW. I never saw the guy wrestle. So I know he was a wrestler. They gave him a non-wrestling gimmick when he first debuted. So I never actually had a chance to watch him wrestle. I have no idea what kind of worker he was or anything like that. For those who don't know, Palmer Cannon was a young kid that WWE signed, and they brought him to SmackDown as a representative of, quote, the network. And he lasted maybe, 6 or 8 months probably before he walked out. They were overseas on an international tour, and he literally walked out. He flew himself home after being mercilessly harassed and bullied by JBL. And I don't think it was just JBL, just to be fair. If I remember the story, I think Chris Benoit was part of that as well. But Bradshaw apparently said and or did some really horrible things to this kid. And it just broke him. He couldn't take it anymore. And the really sad part about it, and I did not know this until I watched the part of the Nova shoot that Anthony is referring to here. Because Hannibal has these clips cut up into little clips on his channel. And Nova said that, Palmer was a good kid and he had moved himself to Georgia. Like, he was really committed to this. And he moved himself to Georgia to train at Deep South. He had a brother who had just been killed around that time in a really bad motorcycle wreck. So he was going through some stuff. And he can remember getting a text message from Palmer saying, "I'm flying myself home. They got me." Or it was something to that effect. And he didn't know what that meant. And he said the one guy who literally ran out after him to try to convince him not to do this, don't fly home, don't throw your whole career away here, was Rey Mysterio. Rey felt so bad about what they did to this kid. And he told him, he said, look, you're one of us. You're one of us. Please don't go. Stay. But Palmer had just, he broke. He'd had enough. He cracked. He was mentally checked out at that point. And a few weeks later, WWE granted him his release, and he was never heard from again. I have no idea if he's even still wrestling today. I have no idea what he's doing. But yeah, those guys, you know, JBL being among them, just harassed this guy so badly. Nova would not even repeat some of the things that were said to this kid because they were so bad. And I certainly hope it didn't involve his dead brother. Just trying to picture Ray running out after him, trying to get him not to throw his entire career away. That sucks. That really sucks. Fuck JBL. Josh from Steventown, New York. People always talk about how fantastic the Attitude Era was, but what does the ruthless aggression have over that period of wrestling? Is it match quality, storytelling, wrestlers, or what? I think it's two things. I think the quality of the matches and the athleticism of the wrestlers. I mean, look at the talent they had on SmackDown during that period, right? Guys in their physical prime. Brock Lesnar, Kurt Angle, Chris Benoit, Eddie Guerrero, Shelton Benjamin, Charlie Haas, Rey Mysterio. That, to me, is what set that era apart from the Attitude Era. Not saying one, you know, which one was better. I'm just saying as far as the things that that period had over the Attitude Era, that is what stands out to me. John in Columbia, Missouri, over the weekend, I watched Survivor Series 1987 and noticed something funny about the ending of the main event. Hulk Hogan gets counted out and he gets sent to the back, leaving Bam Bam Bigelow alone to fight King Kong Bundy, One Man Gang, and Andre the Giant. That's a lot of beef. After Andre pinned Bam Bam clean, here comes Hogan, wielding his title belt as a weapon, no less, wailing on Andre like a sore loser. It reminded me a lot of your rant about the main event from February of 88, where Hogan was rambling incoherently about the plastic surgery payments and the double referees. Is Hulk Hogan from late 87 to early 88 a huge crybaby, spoiled loser instead of the American hero that he was portrayed to be? Absolutely. I said it last week. He was a heel masquerading as a babyface. He attacks Andre with his belt unprovoked. He loses the title to Andre. Now he was screwed over by the crooked referee, if we're being fair here, right? He was screwed over. I'll give him that. But then he's in the back, literally crying. He's yapping about dollar bills falling out of the referee's pockets that aren't there. So now he's seeing things. Plastic surgery. He was a conspiracy theory nut on top of everything else. And I'll do you one better. Go beyond 88. Royal Rumble, 92. Sid eliminates him. Fair and square. What does he do? Sore loser that he is. He helps Ric Flair dump Sid out of the ring. He'd rather let his hated rival win than let another fan favorite get the spotlight. I'm telling you, when Hogan joined Hall and Nash and formed the NWO in 96, it wasn't a heel turn, it was an unveiling. But now we have the direct quote from Hogan himself from that Orlando Sentinel interview this week where he basically says, yes, I was the biggest politician of all time and I did what I had to do to keep my spot, brother. So he doesn't shy away from it. He embraces it. Pierre from Montreal. I was watching the match between Lita and Trish that main evented Raw back in 2004. The dive that Lita did makes me go, oh my God, even today. But so does the dive that The Undertaker did at WrestleMania 25. Buy or sell on the dive that made you go OMG the most, Lita or The Undertaker? Well, it's got to be Undertaker. I mean, Undertaker is... Lita folded herself up like an accordion. That is sickening to watch. I don't know if she actually broke her neck on that or not. I know she broke her neck on the set of Dark Angel when she was filming the TV show. That was like an old James Cameron TV show, I think. She may have broken her neck on that dive as well. If not, I don't know how she didn't. She must be like Gumby. It's sickening to watch. But I thought The Undertaker was dead when he did his dive as well. And The Undertaker is almost 7 feet tall. So here's a 7 foot, 300-pound man hurling himself over the top. You need somebody there to catch him, and there ain't nobody. And thank God for him, quick thinking, he tucked his head at the very last second. Had he not done that, I don't think he would have... Well, for sure he wouldn't have finished the match. I don't think he would have finished his life. I think it might have been over at that point. You see a guy that big coming at you, what must Sim Snuka have been thinking? Or whoever it was, Domino, whoever the fuck was supposed to try to catch this guy. It was Snuka's kid. And I kind of feel bad for him too, because he gets a lot of shit for that. But if you go back and watch it, I mean, he's dressed as a cameraman. He's got this gigantic camera that he's trying to hold in one hand. So he's holding a camera in his hand, and the Undertaker is hurling his body through the air. What is he supposed to do? Catch him with the other hand? So, you know, he got a raw deal, I think, on that also. But of the two, I have to buy on the Undertaker dive. All right, we'll end with a couple of movie questions here. I do want to get to these. Letago from London, England. Buy or sell on the better Robert De Niro movie, Casino or Heat? And to think, both of these movies came out in the same year, 1995. You know what else came out in 1995? Toy Story and Die Hard with a Vengeance, two of my favorite films. And Heat is also on my list of all-time favorite films. Nothing against Casino. Casino was great, too. But Heat just had, I don't know, it had a certain suspense about it. And that first scene ever with Pacino and De Niro sitting across from one another in the diner, you know, you had that great scene, the bank heist scene. I don't know. Other than, I guess, the opening sequence of Saving Private Ryan, if you would consider that to be like an action scene, I don't know that I've ever seen a better... I don't think I've ever seen a better movie shootout scene. How about that? Than the one that we have with the bank heist in Heat. That is an amazing scene. And just such a great movie. So I'm going to buy on Heat and I'm going to sell on Casino. And lastly here, Jerry from Omaha, Nebraska. I follow a fellow named Rob Ager, who has a YouTube channel called Collective Learning. In the spirit of Halloween, a video was posted a few weeks ago on the art of the werewolf transformation in cinema. The two movies analyzed were The Howling and An American Werewolf in London. I personally am not a fan of horror movies, but I wanted to get your take on what you believe is the greatest werewolf transformation you have ever seen in a movie. Well, An American Werewolf in London, I think, is still probably number one. The Howling is also very good. Although that one is gorier. That one is gorier. It's not a bad werewolf transformation. It's just, it's very different. If you want a really good one that I guess doesn't get talked about because it's a movie about vampires and not werewolves, check out the movie Fright Night. I know you said you're not a horror movie fan, but... so maybe you won't watch it, but for everybody else, it's first of all, it's a damn good movie, okay? That's first and foremost. And there is a pretty disturbing scene in this movie where there is a reverse werewolf transformation. So you talk about a werewolf transformation, this was a reverse werewolf transformation. This teenage kid who gets bitten and he becomes a vampire. If you've seen the movie, you know who I'm talking about, Evil Ed, okay? He also ends up becoming a werewolf. Don't ask me how, but he does. But what happens is, as in the scene, he's a werewolf, he gets stabbed through the chest, through the heart, by Roddy McDowall with a wooden stake. And after he is stabbed through the chest with a wooden stake, it's this long, drawn-out, disturbing sequence where the werewolf is like dragging itself along, and it's moaning. And Roddy McDowall is just watching this whole thing with this just look on his face. And it's this slow, painful transformation back into his human form. And, you know, and this is back before CGI. One of the things that I loved about a lot of these horror movies and sci-fi films from the 80s and even the early 90s, you know, The Thing and Fright Night, Terminator, Total Recall. The thing I loved was the use of practical effects. Some people think it looks more fake that way. I'm a big believer in the practical effects in those movies, making them creepier and making them scarier than most of the CGI that I see. CGI can be good. I mean, CGI can be great. Look at Jurassic Park, right? Or even Terminator 2. You know, both Terminators, the first two Terminators are great movies. They're just very different. T2 is known for its effects, and it was a great movie. Jurassic Park, again, CGI in that movie was, especially back when it first came out, it looked unbelievable. But practical effects versus CGI, I always side with practical effects. The prosthetics, the animatronics, especially in The Thing. Like, I'm not talking about the reboot or the prequel or whatever the hell it was that they released a few years ago that I never saw. I'm talking Carpenter's version from 1982, okay? And, you know, somebody disagreed with me last week when I said that the original Halloween is the greatest horror movie of all time. They said they thought it was The Thing. You may be right. I love Halloween, but The Thing creeped me out way more than Halloween did. That chair scene where they're testing for the tainted blood sample. Oh my God. I'm surprised I don't keep a flamethrower under my bed just in case after watching that scene. So anyway, but thank you for the question. That's my my take on the whole werewolf transformation thing and practical effects against CGI effects. I'm always going to side with the practical people. I'm a practical guy. Maybe that's why. I consider myself to be a very practical person, so I go with the practical effects. And I am practically out of time here on this show, so thank you for hanging in there with me. It's been rough with my voice, I know, but I don't know how I got through the show. You heard my voice crack earlier. I didn't think I was going to make it. but here we are. And thank you all the people that use the Lyft code, the promo code that I've been giving out the last few weeks. There are a bunch of people who signed up with it. It's ridiculous too for me because what do I get? I get $2 off. Whenever somebody signs up, when they take that first Lyft ride, it's not like I get a free ride. I get $2 off my ride and it's only good for like a week. So like a lot of them are probably going to expire now. But I got $2 off my ride into Manhattan, my $70 ride into Manhattan. It was $68 instead of $70 yesterday. So even though our meetup may be over, you can still use my Lyft promo code. You got to sign up for a new account and then use the code SOLOMONSTER. And you get, I think it's $5 off your very first ride if you use that promo code. So feel free. I had no choice. I had to take a Lyft into the city last night because the trains were all fucked. And the weather was shit. It was like hellfire and brimstone for a while out there last night with the rain. And my macho tassels were drenched. Would have been a real pain to have to walk to a train, to a shuttle bus. If you saw me in costume, you knew. You knew that was just not going to work out too well. I was stepping on those tassels all night. I'm surprised I didn't trip and fall down the stairs when we left that place. But thank you to everybody who came out last night. I had a great time. I hope you did too. We ended up bouncing. We went from a beer house to another bar. It was a lot of fun. Hopefully we'll do more of these in the future if anybody has any ideas. Because, you know, this was the first one that wasn't directly tied into a wrestling event. We had a pretty good turnout. I know there were more people even who said they were going to come who didn't because of the weather. So for all the people we had, there would have been even a few more last night. And, you know, they don't necessarily need to be always tied into a pay-per-view, you know, that's going on or an NXT TakeOver show that's going on. I'm definitely open to doing more of those. I don't know if my liver is, but I'm open to it. And next weekend, episode 571 is the 11-year anniversary episode of The Sound Off. It was November 6th, 2007. If that was a Tuesday, then it was November 6th, because I remember the very first episode I did was on a Tuesday, the day after Monday Night Raw, and there was a segment on that show with Stone Cold hosing down Santino. It was like this really lame rehash of the beer truck angle. I think he hosed him down with like water or something. I don't know. But that was a 7-minute episode, which you can find on the YouTube channel. You have to go back. I put the first 10 episodes I ever did of The Sound Off. Those first 10 are on the YouTube channel. If you search back, I actually took episode 1 and episode 2, and I merged them together in one video because episode 1 was so short. And as far as all the other ones that are missing, the so-called lost episodes, I've got all of them. They're not online anymore. It's like episode 11 through like 83 or 84 or something. I have all of those episodes. I'm saving them for a rainy day. I don't know if that's a Patreon tier or what, but one day I will bring the lost episodes to those who would like to see them. And yeah, so 11 years coming up next week, and I don't have any special plans at this point. We'll see maybe as the week goes on if I think of any kind of little gimmick I could do for the show, but otherwise, it's a new weekend, a new episode, and onward and upward. So that's next Sunday. Thank you all again. Be well. Stay safe. I'm going to go drink some hot tea. And I will see you tonight after Evolution. I'll have a review up on the YouTube channel. I will be doing the same on Friday for Crown Jewel. And then we'll be back with the 11-year anniversary show next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
And there was one moron who tagged me in a tweet. He says, "Smarks like everything from Japan." This guy has a picture of The Rock as his avatar, and he's quoting wrestling catchphrases on his timeline, calling other people marks and smarks when you've got another man as your profile picture and you're quoting Psycho Sid. Sit the fuck down with that nonsense. You don't get to sit at the adult table when you spew nonsense like that. Go stand in the corner and face the wall.
Since 2007, The Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster Sound Off.